also please on record that I'm sure this room is not very conducive for meeting of the committee, especially because there's no recording system and all this of the road which will get a better attended for meeting. Having said that, the agenda of this meeting today is to listen to the Department of Education on this strategic plan for 2008-2009 and this budget for this financial, that financial year, the priorities that the department has in mind and how those priorities are funded in this current financial year. That is, I think, the purpose of this. Now, without much ado, I am going to allow the Director General to take a lot more. And thereafter, we'll allow members to ask questions, we'll comment. And by the way, we will also be debating the new budget point. I mean, in the future, some way, we will have an opportunity to debate. And therefore, I think we must pay some particular attention to the issues as raised, so that when we debate, we will take those issues into consideration. Having said that, I want to, without much ado, call upon the Director General. I see Suleiman's hand is up. He is the committee's whip, and I can't deny him that opportunity. Yes, he will go to the ANC and tell them that I'm not still confident. I will not be the least next year.
I hope that's all of the record. I see the light is on. Chairperson, just to say that one is very disappointed in the venue over here. I think our staff must make proper arrangements. And if this is going to happen again, I will be the first one to walk out of this meeting. Honestly speaking, we want a proper venue where we can record whatever's been discussed here and so forth and so on. We cannot allow this to happen again, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you Chairperson and honourable members, and thank you for this opportunity to present. We did circulate hard copies of the presentation. I think, given the venue, it's appropriate we work from that, Chair. Can I just introduce then Dr. Chris Madiba, Chief Director, Strategic Planning in our department. So he's responsible for much of this work, and Mr. Dingani Ngobeni, Director in the Office of the DG. Chairperson, we do appreciate this opportunity, and I think the timing is very good. We're about to, in a sense, finalize our strategic plan so that we can table this in good time before the budget speech. And we really would appreciate, I think, the input of this committee today and perhaps after today as well, that we can feed in your thoughts and ideas into this strategic plan as well. But this is then a presentation of what we've got on the table at the moment, that we are, as I say, finalizing at the moment. Chair, there are, of course, two parts to our strategic plan. One is the five-year plan, 2008 to 2012. But more specifically, of course, it also includes the operational plans for the coming financial year, together with the budget attached to those. Chair, we do have some budget figures at the end of the presentation, which I'll come to. I'm not sure that they will give you as much detail as you might like, and perhaps we need to then share with you more details of the operational plan and bit by bit of the different activities and the amounts allocated. We've got some broad figures here, which will give you a sense, I hope, of our priority areas. Chairman, if I can move to the second slide and stress that in this particular year we're not looking at a sudden departure from what has gone before, so we refer to the Minister's continuing vision for education, and it's very much, I believe, in line with government mandate to impact more urgently and more directly on the three areas of poverty, unemployment and social cohesion, and the way that we contribute to that is by providing quality education for all. So that is intended to drive all that we do and keep us focused on those particular issues. And in line with the continuing vision, Chair, is a set of continuing approaches which were strongly led by the Minister when she came into office. The first was a call for our policy to be continually informed by evidence and not by ideology, and that has been a very strong element of evidence-based policy approaches. More effective implementation. I think we've all agreed that that is the downfall of the system at the moment, and implementation is certainly a big focus of our work. Part of that is also about improved information about the system. Very often the evidence we've had is scanty, it's not sufficient to work on, so we've got a number of initiatives you'll see in the presentation, Chair, about how we improve the sort of information we have about what is happening in the system, and I'll touch on some of those. One of them, at least, though, is in terms of monitoring learner performance through learning outcomes. We need to know whether children indeed are learning or not. There are a number of initiatives there, and in particular with our younger children, grade 3 and grade 6 assessments that we're now looking to do on a regular basis, not just annually, in fact even quarterly, to really get a sense as to whether our children are learning or not, and that ultimately is our business, learner performance. We're looking at the use of ICTs. We have just finished a feasibility study in regard to the introduction of ICTs in schools together with National Treasury. We're now to the stage of what's called an options analysis, where we're looking at the different options. Do we provide desktops? Do we go laptops? If we go laptops, what sort, et cetera? All of that is at the final stage now, and I think in the next short while we'll see a huge rollout of ICTs into our schools and training institutions. And we continue, again, at the insistence of the Minister, on building partnerships. We have very strong partnerships with business, particularly around AFT colleges, universities. But one of the areas we've neglected, I think, is our partnerships with NGOs, and I'm glad to say that we are increasing there, particularly around issues of school safety, social cohesion, etc. So that's part of our continuing approaches as well. Okay, the five priorities that were identified for this term of office. The first one, quite clearly, dealing with poverty, and that has a number of elements to it. The major one, obviously, is around access, around the cost of education, the declaration of no-fee schools. We're happy that we've moved to 40% now, and certainly we're planning to move to the 60% threshold that has been mandated. I think it's going to be quite feasible. I have no doubt it is making a difference to many poor learners getting access to school. There are administrative issues, I know, around this that we need to still deal with, but I have no doubt it has been a progressive move. The National School Nutrition Program, we've just received a review report that was done by KPMG on this program, and their response is that although there are obviously certain problems in certain areas, overall there's no doubt it is making a contribution, and particularly they indicated making a contribution to the ability of children to learn, and in the end, again, that's what we're trying to ensure. And a focus on rural education. It's not to assume that poverty is only residing in rural areas, but we do know that many rural areas are indeed multiply deprived, and particular attention given to the provision of schooling in those areas. We've also, though, Chair, been mandated by government to lead the National Human Resource Development Strategy, and it's fairly obvious that our contributions to that are in terms of our institutional base. FET colleges, both the schools and the colleges, a particular element of that human resource development, skills, intermediate skills development, higher education and the kind of outputs we get there, particularly in skills areas, we've given attention to. We're giving increasing attention to adult education. I'll come back to that in a while. And, of course, our math literacy campaign I'll mention as well. And then, as I say, on behalf of government, we also coordinate broadly the HRD strategy, which involves a whole range of different departments and bits of government. A third area is that of quality improvement. We've, to a large extent, I think, made progress on the access side of things. It's the quality challenge that remains in many of our institutions. And increased attention to health education, linked to our school nutrition program, but linked also to things like physical education in schools, etc. And finally, institutional development, which I'll come back to, but that refers to all levels of the system, just trying to make sure they work. in terms of the ministerial goals, Chair, for the coming year, obviously we do want major progress in all of these areas, is firstly to improve our learning outcomes in the foundation phases, right reading, writing and numeracy, but also maths and science higher up the system. There are a number of initiatives there that I'll come back to, but perhaps I should mention at this stage, Chair, that last night the Minister launched what is known as Foundations for Learning campaign. I suppose some have characterized it as a back-to-basics campaign, just trying to make sure that every teacher, every parent, every learner understands in pure and simple terms what is expected of them in grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. We've been quite specific to say you should be reading for 30 minutes a day, you should be calculating for this much, you should have 10 minutes of mental arithmetic every day, just trying to put those things in place so there's no confusion, no ambiguity in the system about what's expected, and then also that Foundation's campaign has national standardized tests for our grade 3s, grade 6s, to make sure that they are indeed achieving what we're hoping to achieve. The target there is to try and double our performance in reading, writing, and numeracy at those basic levels. I'll come back to that, Chair, maybe. We did publish a government gazette on Friday, that last Friday, the 14th of March, that spells out the Foundations for Learning campaign. And I'd really urge that we all get hold of that and have a look at it, because it really spells out what it is we're expecting to happen there. The e-learning issue, as I've indicated, is going to be a major front at the moment. We've got some very interesting developments in that area with the so-called second chance program for matrics who failed last year. We've established some 270 centres across the country, and in partnership with SABC and Centec, we've been able to get video TV streams into those centres. So every day from 1 until 5, there's a continuous stream of learning programs in the different subject areas, and then they repeat it again from 5 until 9. We anticipated about 100,000 learners would sign up for that program. The current indications are that some 160,000 learners have in fact signed up for that second chance program. And I fear that there are in fact possibly some children who are doing matric, but actually also going in the afternoon to the second chance programs. And I think it's evidence of the value of these ICTs. These are phone-in centres, so from these centres you can actually interact with the presenter at live, as it's been shown. And I think what you're seeing is children getting access to top-quality teaching and top-quality materials through these Centec centres, and I think that's an indication of how positively we can use e-learning in our schools. Increasing the number of no-fee schools, I've referred to, we're planning with the provinces now for that move to 60%, and I'm sure we can achieve it. The recapitalisation of FET colleges, this is the last year now of the FET recap grant, and we want to make sure that it is well used and that all our colleges are properly equipped. The big one, Kariguri, mass literacy campaign, it was launched by the Deputy President a couple of weeks ago. This is obviously a huge program that we're mounting. I'll talk a little bit about it in a moment, but this is no longer at a conceptual stage. It's actually on its way now. We're also looking at a review of adult education programs. At the moment, our adult education programs are very closely aligned to a school-based program. It's equivalent to the Level 4 adult education qualification is aligned to a Grade 9 qualification in schools. But we've also made it not just aligned, but rather similar to, so that these adults have to also do life orientation and they have to do all the 8 learning areas, etc. And of course, for many adults, these are not relevant. This is not what they're looking for. They're going there to either develop a particular skill or to advance in a particular way. So and you'll notice we're not using the term adult basic education anymore. We see adult education as part of that lifelong program that all of us should be involved in this at different stages. Last year, Chair, with your assistance, we passed the Education Laws Amendment Act, and we're looking to implement that this year. A number of elements. One is the establishment of a National Education and Training Council, but more practical elements for the schools is, of course, the issue of the search and seizure provisions that law provided for, and we are hoping that will have an impact during the course of this year. We want to build on the Funza Lushaka teacher bursary, a very exciting program that has dramatically increased the number of young students in teacher training. And our first 800 graduated at the end of last year. They've been placed in our schools, and all of these are scarce subject areas. It's a very exciting program. And improving the school nutrition program. That's a bit of a shopping list, Chair, but all of them, I think we'd agree, are critically important, and we're hoping certainly in this last year of this particular term of office, we will achieve at least these goals. As a department, we've had to then assess how we achieve these goals of the Minister, and the first thing we've stressed is to emphasize the whole issue of continuity and stability. Now, I'm a little cautious on this one because, of course, we're in a mode of business unusual, and it might sound odd to say that we're emphasizing continuity and stability, but I think what we're talking about here is that we're not looking at initiating new policies, new directions, sudden shifts in emphasis in any way. We're saying what we've got in legislation and policy and regulations, etc., is appropriate and it should stand. The business unusual element is in making these things work and work more effectively. So it really is about business unusual in terms of implementation, how we work with provinces, and we've become a lot more interventionist, I think, in that regard, how we monitor provinces, how we keep people accountable right through the system for the work they're doing. That, for us, is the business unusual. It's not about now writing suddenly new policies and, as I say, taking up new directions. So we try to send signals to the system to say, this is work that needs to be done. Get on with it rather than sitting debating about what if, what about, et cetera, et cetera. Strengthening monitoring and evaluation, as I say, is a critical one. And the information sources I spoke about earlier, it's strengthening our EMIS system, our Education Management and Information System, important. But the new initiative that we will be putting in place during the course of this year is what we call LURIT. It's a Learner Unit Record and Information Tracking System. One of the problems we've got with EMIS at the moment is that we only collect aggregate numbers. So we go to a school and we say, how many learners you got in the school? 120. And that's fine, we put 120, so we know how many learners there are in the system, et cetera, how many there are in each school. But of course, we don't know who those individuals are, who those 120 children are. And that creates enormous problems because we do know that children move around in our system. They move from school to school within a locality, within a province. But, of course, even more, we do find children moving between provinces. And it's very complicated because Gauteng tells us, and I've no reason to disbelieve them, that they attract some 30,000 additional learners every year. I think Western Cape is in a very similar position. And they have to then accommodate those with teachers, classrooms, etc. But you try and find one province that will admit to having lost those 30,000 learners, and we don't find it. Now, clearly, money follows the learners, so they're not easily going to admit to that, and we've acknowledged, Chair, that until we have a comprehensive system with every learner in the system tracked on a database with their ID numbers, so we can see if a learner has moved from this school to that school, we know exactly where they are, we know how many learners per school, per province, per district, everything else, that really is going to be, I think, the real information we need. This will also, the tracking part will also keep records of the learner's performance. So if we suddenly find a learner repeating a grade once, maybe all right, but the minute they repeat a second time, there should be red lights flashing on the screen. There's a problem here. What's happening to this learner? Let's find out. Let's intervene, etc. All of that, I think, becomes possible with LURIT. We do have, in the Western Cape and the Northern Cape, they already have something like this, and we'll be building on that system that they have. But ultimately, as I say, a national system is going to be absolutely critical in managing it, ensuring that the funds flow. One of the concerns we have when we did a little audit of our EMIS numbers is we went individually to schools and did a head count, and to be honest, Chair, where some schools had said we have 200 learners, on the day we got there we could only find 150. The principal would say, no, well, you know, some are absent and they've maybe gone here and they're there. But the truth is, in the end, we estimated something like a 17% over-reporting by schools on numbers. Now, when you think that those numbers attract teachers and they attract money, that over-reporting means that some 17% of our school allocations are actually being misdirected. They're going to schools who don't deserve that money, and presumably there's schools somewhere else who should be getting that money. So this will certainly put a stop to that kind of thing. That's going to be a key element. The research element I've spoken about also to understand and improve the system. Part of that is the international studies we participate in, and while the results, I'm sure, are always a disappointment to us, we've acknowledged that those results must be a spur to something. We need to either change policy if it's wrong, we need to implement better if that's where the problem is. All of these things must help us understand what it is we need to do, so we are very open to that sort of research. In the end, teachers are the key in our system, so teacher development, we are ready now to implement the so-called CPTD system, the Continuing Professional Teacher Development System. It'll be a system based on points, and you'll have to earn 150 points every 3 years, etc. We are putting that in place during the course of this year, and that will hopefully move our teachers. And in the end also, the issue of districts, absolutely critical. These are the engine rooms of our system, and while we have some provinces with very strong districts, we also know that there are many provinces with very weak districts, and we have to build them. So that's more or less an overview of where we're going. If I can quickly reflect then on some of the specifics, and the first slide is just to indicate the way we're organized in the department. Our administration branch obviously there, but otherwise we're organized firstly in the three bands of the NQF, general education, further education, and higher education. And then we have our two cross-cutting branches, planning and monitoring, that does all the financial planning and monitoring issues, and social and school enrichment, which is the program that works on many other areas that I'll touch on just now. On the systems planning and monitoring one, and I'm not going to talk about administration, I'm sure that's taken as read. The systems planning and monitoring one is really about the issues of norms and standards. We've got now norms and standards for funding of schools, of ECD, of ABET centers. We've prepared norms around FET college funding, which are with Treasury still for approval at this stage. So those are largely parked. But if you recall your legislation from last year, also allowed now the Minister to develop national norms and standards for school infrastructure. This is going to be a critical area of work during the course of this year. We do recognize, in part, these will be aspirational. We can't just write a policy now that says every school will have a library and suddenly think that it's going to happen. But we do need to set a standard and say this is what a school should have, and obviously we have to develop a plan to move towards that. But there's some immediate norms, certainly, that we know we can apply. One of them would be textbooks. We want 6 textbooks on the desk of every grade 10, 11, and 12. That should be non-negotiable. There's no way you can learn without a textbook for every subject. We want a certain number of textbooks for our primary school learners, etc. Those sort of things we can specify immediately because the funds are there. It's just the way how we organize ourselves. And there's also talk about even norms around, for example, the minimum size and perhaps maximum size of a school. We've got schools at the moment over 2,000 learners. That's really far too big for an educational institution, so we want to cut that. But the truth is we've also got some 300 or so at least schools, probably even more in the country, that have less than 50 learners. And in all honesty, that's economically inefficient, we know that, but more importantly, it's educationally inefficient. You cannot have efficient teaching in a school with some 50 learners. Very often you'll have to have 2 or 3 teachers, so it's an expensive resource in terms of applying teachers, but the truth is even the educational quality is not good because you've then got multi-grades, etc. So you'll see, for example, in Free State, they've been closing down many of these schools, less than 50 learners, and they're either accommodating those learners in hostels on a weekly border basis, or else they're providing transport to ensure those learners still get access to schools. But that will be part of the norms and standards process we'll discuss. The EMIS issue I've spoken about, strengthening EMIS, and part of that will be our LURIS system to ensure that we properly plan, properly monitor, and that will be ongoing work. We continue from this branch to get a continual analysis on education expenditure and what's happening to it, particularly, of course, educational allocations and expenditure within provinces, and reporting on that. Within the next couple of weeks, we will be calling a priorities in Darba with all the provinces to look at our budgeting bids for the 2009-10 financial year, so very early in the year. We start assessing what are the needs, what are we going to have to put in for, and they do all that sort of work. They also cover the area of labor relations. It got a little tense last year, of course, although we weren't directly responsible for those salary negotiations. They are, of course, at the moment negotiating the occupation-specific dispensation, the the notorious now OSD, and if any of you know any teachers, that's probably the first question I ask you, is what's happening to OSD. I'm very happy to say, Chair, that there is a council meeting of the ELRC meeting today. The employee parties will be putting a counter proposal on the table. From what we've seen of it, it looks very optimistic, and it might well be that within the next week or so we could be getting an agreement with our teachers on the OSD. It's a very attractive package. It does provide for an across-the-board increase to all teachers, but more importantly for us beyond that, it provides for progression based on performance. And the bottom line is that good teachers are going to be much better paid. Ordinary teachers will be okay, they'll be paid but if you want to be regarded as good or you want to be regarded as outstanding, which will get you significant increases every 2 years, we said the provision is that then you need to invite an inspector in. We don't use the term inspector, a moderator, into the classroom to ensure that the assessment of either good or outstanding is in fact a justified one. So we've been able to bridge it there. We're saying we're not forcing anyone to be inspected. If you want just your normal 1% every year for the next 50 years, so be it. You can just keep going and that's no problem. But if you want those increased benefits, you need to then invite that moderator in to ensure that you are good, that you are excellent. So in a way, we've broken, I think, the back of this whole issue of accountability, inspections, etc., and I think that's a massive breakthrough. So we will see, I think, the good teachers now, and hopefully it'll be part of the retention of our good teachers under this OSD. We'll talk to you more about it perhaps when we've got an agreement with the teachers. We'll come and spell out what it is. The issue of service delivery improvement plans, ongoing reporting that this branch does, and then, as I say, the issue of funding norms and standards, largely we have covered there. The FET College one is the final one. We need the concurrence of Minister of Finance on that one. Chair, in terms of general education, this is our grades R to 9. One is most important, expanding access to quality early childhood opportunity. And perhaps you should just clarify, Chair, the term gets a bit misunderstood, I think. There are two parts to our ECD work. The one is what's known as the integrated ECD program, the one we run together with Department of Social Development and Department of Health. These are largely in community-based sites. So these are not school-based programs. These are catering for your 0 to 4-year-olds, your preschoolers. And that program from our side is simply to ensure that the teachers are properly trained, those who are offering these ECD as carers in some way, not trained as full teachers, as it were. They're fairly low-level qualifications, but they should know about child development, etc. And the second is to try and provide these ECD centers with the kind of resources, charts, pictures, toys, whatever they might be, that will ensure that children are stimulated in the right way in that age group, 0 to 4. The second part of our ECD work is the grade R itself, that reception year that 5-year-olds should be in, the 1 year of preschooling. All the international evidence tells you that educationally this is the most valuable program you can offer, that children who have a year of preschool are far more likely to continue their schooling, finish their schooling, do well at schooling, all of those things. So it's absolutely critical. We have at the moment about 600,000 learners enrolled in grade R. We committed to universal enrollment, which would be nearly 1 million learners by 2010. So we should see in the next year another 100,000 or so in 2009, and then probably the remainder would come in 2010, and we would want to see all 5-year-olds having at least that opportunity of 1 year of preschooling. The second big program, and it's also at the junior level, is the so-called Kids Up initiative that is about providing resources to our poorer schools in particular. We've identified the poorest districts across the country and schools within those. We're giving them things like the reading toolkits. It's a wonderful box that we've prepared, a big steel trunk that you see, and the idea is that in that box is everything a teacher would need to teach reading. It's got the reading books, it's got the so-called reading sets that children use, it's got flashcards, it's got charts, it's got posters, it's got everything that they should need, and we're trying as far as possible from our side to roll these out, but of course we're also dependent on the provinces to purchase these and get them into schools, but I think teachers who have these are certainly going to be able to do a lot more with them. and other resources also under KidsUp. But once again, it's not just giving resources, it's saying we want to see an improvement as a result of those resources, so we would also assess learning performance within those schools. That's a big one that is finally picking up with the provinces investing a lot more in our KidsUp programs. The implementation of the curriculum, I think this is very much linked to the Foundation for Learning campaign I spoke about a moment ago, and I do have copies now of the Gazette. But I would also understand this, Chair, as our part of the national call to make education a priority in this country. Our understanding is that the community more broadly, political groupings, whoever they might be, we would ask them as part of the overall Making Education a Priority campaign to ensure that our teachers and our pupils get to the classroom door, as it were, on time, prepared, etc., etc. Our job is then to make sure that when they enter the classroom, they know what they're doing, they're clear about it, they have the facilities and resources to do what's needed, and I think if we can see those two working together, then we start to build a social mobilization around education that should make it work a lot better. And then finally, from this on this slide, Chair, the inclusive education policy. We, as part of this, are looking very strongly at our special schools. I regret to say they've been neglected over the past few years, particularly around resources and infrastructure. We've invested a lot of money in the past year. We'll continue to do so this year. But at the same time, we also are building a better sense of inclusive education. And one of the things we've developed and will be implemented during this year is what's known as a screening, identification, and assessment tool. We want to make sure, we must understand in a special school, children get about 5 or 6 times spent on them what they would get in an ordinary school, and clearly that's necessary and it's appropriate. But the key is, of course, then you need to ensure that the right children get into those institutions, that those who need that kind of support and investment most of all are the ones who get into those schools. Regrettably, we have seen some cases where children, to be honest, with fairly mild learning problems are then into a special school. They get this wonderful attention and resource provision for them, but in fact, you could say quite honestly, they are more deserving learners, and those children should rightly probably be in an ordinary school with some support and attention given to them then. So that would be an element that we would be working on. General education also deals with the whole field of teacher education, and I've spoken about the Funza Lushaka bursaries, and I hope that all of us are trying to promote this and broadly to promote teaching as a profession. The news obviously is good. There are many more opportunities for teachers than there have been perhaps over the past few years. These bursaries are very generous. They're full cost bursaries, so they cover not just tuition but residence and other costs as well. The obligation, of course, having received the Funza Lushaka bursary is that you are then obliged to work for us for an equivalent period. So we're addressing that issue, I think, quite nicely. The issue of professional leadership at school, I think we all know the importance of leadership. We have this year for the first time had some 400 principals and aspirant principals in what we've called an advanced certificate in school leadership. It's been offered at about half a dozen of our universities across the country. If these 400, we want to be sure that it isn't just a qualification, that it is something, in fact, that makes them better managers at the school level. And obviously, on an evaluation of this program and the effect it has, we will dramatically expand the number of principals who would be going into this program. Ultimately, we'd want to, in fact, make it a condition for being a school principal that you should have completed this program. So that would be a future step. The General Education Branch has established an evaluation unit, and this evaluation is directly of learner performance. We do a number of measures of learner performance, some of them like the international ones, some are regional, like our SACMEC study that we do in the SADC region, but more and more ourselves and part of the Foundation's program will also be, as I said, grade 3, grade 6 testing at regular levels, pulling in that data from the district, provincial and national level, trying to get a sense of whether we are indeed getting better at these things. The next bullet is a repeat, I'm sorry, and then finally the up-to-date data of school performance. That's part of the work of the evaluation unit. Chair, if I turn now to further education and training, We focus first on the schools, and one of the areas is obviously just to continue to increase the number of FEQ learners who are completing school. We released last week, Chair, and I hope you've got a copy, the retention report that was done by us, by a ministerial committee for us. The ministerial committee indicated that up until grade 9, we really have very little problem of retention. Most, if not all, of our learners effectively now are completing their 9, if not 10 years of schooling up to the end of grade 9, and that's a good sign, and I think it certainly meets the universal basic education requirement of the Millennium Development Goals. But what the report also identified is that from grade 10, we do start to see quite significant dropouts, and that happens right through grade 10, 11, and sadly even grade 12. It seems extraordinary that someone would spend 11 and a half years of schooling and then suddenly halfway through grade 12, and certainly there must be some conditions causing it, that they are forced then to leave school. And that's certainly a hugely unfortunate element. We want to try and ensure that they remain in school, that they do complete, and particularly that they do complete in these scarce skills areas. You would recall, of course, that every learner now for the new matric this year is doing mathematics or mathematics literacy. It's a huge stage that we've reached, and obviously the end of this year will be extraordinarily interesting in terms of the matric results on this new matric. This links to the next point, the modern, relevant, high-level curricula. I believe that the curriculum we do have now in our grade 10 to 12 program is indeed a modern and relevant program. Certainly the universities are very excited. They believe it is a high level. We've internationally benchmarked some of them as well. So we've certainly, I think, plugged it there. Our challenge now is to make sure our learners are able to cope with that curriculum. The national exam system, again, for the first time this year, the matric exam will all be nationally set. There are only 29 subjects now instead of the 100 and something that there used to be, with national papers and provincial papers and everything else in between. We've now got simply 29 national papers. Huge advantage. It means we can start the matric exam much later, so that disruption of schooling that used to start from October sometime when matric started writing, now we're only starting on the 5th of November. It's much later in the year, less subjects, quicker marking, better monitoring, all of that sort of stuff I think is going to have us in a position to really talk about a national exam system. And I've spoken about the e-education by 2013. Remember, the commitment is that every learner should emerge from school at least ICT literate, if not further than that. Also on the schools and further education and training, I've mentioned the implementation of the curriculum. Chair, based on the success last year of the recovery plan and the newspaper inserts that we provided there, which were called Study Mates, the extraordinary popularity of these Study Mates has forced us this year to continue with them. So on a regular basis, probably on a monthly basis, we will be putting out it's an 8-page insert into our newspapers called Study Mates. Fairly simple, it's a motivational, 230 days before the exam start. It talks about the exam timetable already, spells out some things, very nice little bits about diet and academic performance, what you need to eat in order to be able to study better, a checklist, how ready are you for your exams, all of those kind of things. And for all of us perhaps in this room, Chair, there's a section called Tips for Toppies, and I suppose we're the O-Toppies here, yeah? It says, are you a parent, etc., and here are a couple of tips for you as a parent, how you can help your child. So all of those kind of things, Chair, I think are going to be part of that support that we're trying to provide for the curriculum. We're moving much stronger in terms of textbooks, Chair, given the problems we've had, towards a standardized textbook catalogue. We're doing the vetting of these textbooks at the national level. We are choosing the best, and it's not just us. We're bringing in a lot of higher education specialists as well, really trying to choose which are good textbooks and, to be honest, which are rubbish, and there are a lot of them, and trying to standardize that a lot more so that provinces then buy off that national textbook catalogue, and that's helped us, I think. Of course, we publish reports on the senior certificate exam, the issue of dropout and repeater rates I've spoken about. Here we have acknowledged, Chair, the need for alternative programs. Many grade 10, 11s, the retention report indicated the possible reasons for people to drop out. Some of them were financial, and obviously that's a bigger problem we can't deal with, but many of them did say that both the curriculum and the context of the school was not conducive to, and let's be honest, some of these are children who've repeated once or twice, they may be 18 years old sort of thing. They just don't fit into a school context. And there's a very real sense that we need to look at other kind of institutional forms, the sort of college thing, but not necessarily a technical college, but some sort of different format where children would feel more comfortable and hopefully would then finish their matric before dropping out. And increasing the number of dinner lady schools. You'll recall the president has set us a target of 500. I'm glad to say at the moment we've got 497 dinner lady schools. We're going to identify three more across the provinces, and they would be our focus schools on maths and science. On our FET colleges, Chair, that first bullet should really read develop further programs and gazette requirements for the National Certificate Vocational. At the moment, we have some 29 programs also in our FET colleges, very high level demand, engineering, construction, ICT, etc. We want to look and see if there are further programs that are on short supply in this country that we can put through. We're very happy this year. You know, a lot of people told us we'd never get people to sign up for these NCB programs, these college programs. In our year two now of that NCB program, I'm happy to say that we set a target of 40,000 learners. The report we got yesterday indicates that we now have 53,000 learners in our NCB programs, year two at the colleges. So clearly there's been a huge demand. Once again, of course, the bursaries there have assisted. We are paying bursaries for students to study at these programs. But even if they don't get bursaries, we have significantly capped the fees for these NCB programs. They are highly affordable, and many students are, in fact, paid their own way. So this is going to be, I'm sure, a major contribution to our skills base in the country. Part of it is done through building partnerships. We're working with the CETAs in many areas. We're working with business. The construction industry, for example, has recapitalized two colleges in each of the provinces. They've said these are the colleges where we want our future building engineers to come from. So they've actually put money into making sure they've got the right equipment and stuff, making sure the lecturers are there. That sort of partnership very useful as well. Recapitalization, as I say, it's the final year. We want to be sure that the colleges have everything they need for that. And as I said, the funding norms and standards are not yet finalized, but should be in the next short while. We are concerned about the throughput and placement rates. We're very encouraged, as I say, by the enrollment in our NCB program, but sadly, the pass rates in the first year were not very impressive, and regrettably, of course, it's the old maths that has pulled them down as well. Maths is a compulsory subject. You have to pass it. So learners who failed maths, in a sense, failed the year, and that has caused us concern. We've got to continually work with our college lecturers to make sure they do do what is needed in that regard. Again, ICT, all of our colleges are now ICT connected. They've all got internet connectivity, and there's no limitation on that one. And because the colleges do their own assessments in year one and year two, we want to make sure that these are credible so that when they hit year three and write the national exam, they don't suddenly find themselves out of kilter. Chair, last few programs, the social and school enrichment one, a growing area of our work, and the first one obviously being in the media very recently, the issue of creating safe and caring schools. Supporting schools. And Chair, we do need to be a little bit clear on this one. The Human Rights Commission, which released this report last week, found that in 25% of our schools, there had been an incident of violence in the last month. Now, that is shocking, and it's far too many, and we need to address that. But we do need to recognize that the other side of the equation means that some 75% of our schools did not experience any incidents of violence in the past period. So the idea that every school in our country is a violently dangerous place, that some have said now that it's more dangerous to be at school than outside of the school gate, I have to say, Chair, that those sort of readings of that report are certainly nothing there. The Human Rights Commission, firstly, very clearly indicated that this was an issue of society at large and not purely of the education sector, and I think in that sense they have come out with a very balanced report, but of course the media doesn't always pick up on that balance and they've tended to highlight this. And nevertheless, we are working on this number of programs around safety and security in schools, and I'm very encouraged. The one school that we as a national department invested in last year with fencing and security lights, etc., their pass rate at the school, it was in New Hanover here, a very violent area. Their pass rate at that school went up from some 33% the previous year to to nearly 70% last year. So, and they put it purely down to the fact that they do have all these safety elements in the school now. So clearly it makes a difference to learning and performance, and we've got to continue to push that. If you look, though, at all your provincial budgets for the coming year, you'll see many of them have budgeted significant amounts for issues of school safety. Secondly, the whole gender imperative, the participation success rates of girl learners. This is one we've got to watch very closely, of course. More girls are passing matric at the moment than boys, and that's a very good sign, but they're not all doing math, science, etc. So that's really the push for the gateway subjects rather than more broadly. I've indicated the review of our adult education and training issue, and that review should be produced in the course of the coming year. The Kariguni Math Literacy Program, very nice sub-slogan that this program has adopted. They use the term wherever you are. And the whole idea of that is that it's not about adult learners or adults looking for literacy now having to find the nearest center and travel there to get there. We've said wherever you are, the idea is the program should come to you. So we set a minimum limit of 15 learners. If any body can identify 15 learners in a particular place who want literacy training, that then will become a Kariguni center. We will deploy a tutor to that place, and those 15 learners will indeed be offered the literacy programs, the six-month program. There's some wonderful materials that have been developed. The first we've appointed a CEO now for this program, and the first classes are commencing on the 14th of April. This month we're busy training the trainers, and from the middle of April they will be going out and they will be doing the actual teaching. The Minister of Education has already challenged the President to identify 15 learners and perhaps to become an literacy tutor himself, but I think it's a challenge for all of us broadly to say, are there not 15 people in the road where we live who would want literacy training, and if so, could we ourselves not do that teaching, or at least find someone who could do it? Kariguni is committed to giving you the materials. It will pay the stipend to the tutor. It's not a salary, let's be clear, but it certainly covers the cost of participation, and I think if we can really make this one work, it's going to make a huge impact broadly on the development of our society. So a very important one, and perhaps, Chair, at a future meeting, it might be nice to get a full report and presentation on this program. School sports is an issue. We have a protocol now with Sports and Recreation South Africa that we take responsibility for all in-school activities, phys ed at school, extramurals in the afternoon, etc. They take responsibility for national events, competitions, tournaments, etc. I'm not convinced yet that this is a proper breakdown, because there are still some issues of concern to get a national level, but we are driving very strongly the fact that every learner at least once a week, twice a week I think, has at least 30 minutes of physical education in the school. You don't need fancy equipment for this. You need to go outside, take your shoes off, jump up and down, do some star jumps or whatever it might be, but simply getting people doing exercise, part of school, and then of course it's part of the extramural side as well. We're pushing on that one. The HIV and AIDS conditional grant is continuing. It's a peer education program. We're not claiming sole credit for it, Chair, but I think you would have seen the latest HIV statistics do indicate that among the 15 to 19-year-olds there is in fact a decline in new prevalences of HIV, and hopefully it might be something that is being done in our schools. Children are indeed understanding and changing behavior as a result. And then finally, Chair, is the work they do in the school nutrition program, a massive program here. You'll see in the funding when we get to it at the end that there's been a dramatic increase now in the money for that. We did ask for even more money with the hope of being able to extend this program to secondary schools. Regrettably, the allocation we've got was not sufficient for us to stretch it that far, and what we've said rather is that the additional money that we do get, let's rather make the primary program more effective. One of the things we've done is that currently we only feed for 156 days a year. We've said from the new financial year it must be every school day, so I think that would be an improvement. And we've also moved the cost of a meal up from some R1.30 per child per day up to R1.50 per child per day. And I think you would appreciate that even for R1.50 you don't buy a huge amount of food. It's probably as good as we can do. So until, as I say, we get more funding, we would rather just say let's ensure that we properly feed our primary school learners. Some provinces, like the Western Cape, of course, have added their own money to this program, and they have therefore extended the program to secondary learners, but that's the particular condition that they have here, that they're able to do that. But otherwise, we're focusing on approving the primary school program. Higher education chair, also been in the news a bit recently for all the wrong reasons. Our role here is firstly providing regulatory support to higher education, checking that in particular quality of programs, etc., is there, providing academic research and institutional support to our universities. There's a lot of work being done around what's termed the internationalization of higher education. There's a huge amount of work being done by universities, particularly on the African continent. We have UNISA, of course, already opening offices and centers in a number of different countries. But more than that, we're using our higher education institutions to assist various countries. For example, a bilateral agreement we have with the DRC provided that we should offer training and planning. Complication was that they were all speaking French and none of our universities do, but what we've actually done is we've funded BITS now to put together a program in macro education planning, and we've also funded a translator. So the program now will be offered by BITS in French, and we've sponsored a number of DRC education planners to come and spend a year in South Africa attending this course. So a lot of those sort of things are being done by universities. We've also wanted them to focus on quality graduates in particular areas of socioeconomic development. We've put a lot more funding into our engineering faculties, into science broadly in our universities. But that shouldn't mean that we don't also recognize the importance of humanities in other areas as part of the social development side. Institutional diversity is part of the national plan, and that includes our National Institutes of Higher Education in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape. Haven't really taken off yet, but are starting to. More and more students are registering in these institutes, and they're starting to work now, I think. And then finally, a monitoring and evaluation function, of course, that is done. Chair, then I just turn to some of the financials, and as I say, this is a fairly broad brushstroke, but we'll provide details if you want. Firstly, to just note education as a whole, this is national and provincial. We in this current financial year, overall national and provincial totaled 106.3 billion. In the coming year, it moves up to 122.8 billion, so a substantial increase in the coming year. But you will see, Chair, that the national slice has not increased significantly. It's about 500 million increase that we have got, but you will see the huge increase, in fact, is in the provincial level from 89 billion up to 104 billion in the coming year. It's a 15% increase that they have received. We then move up into the outer years of the MTF. Further growth, the dramatic 134 billion and 147 billion, and some of that certainly comes to the national department, but again, a major share of that increase goes to your provincial department, moving from 104 billion to 114 billion and to 124 billion over the next 2 years. So substantial increases that we are seeing. Of course, these are all paper budgets. What we need to ensure is that that allocation to the provinces indeed gets into the provincial education departments. We have found, unfortunately, that at times the money that is supposedly allocated to education as part of the block grant doesn't get down into the education department itself, and we hope that yourselves as honourable members of the NCOP can just track that a little bit as well. Just a breakdown there of the provincial education budget. By province, I'm not going to go through them, but that just breaks them down bit by bit. We need to be a little bit careful. Some of the increases are a bit misleading. For example, Northwest, it looks like they've got a very limited growth, but of course they are the province that has shed some of their areas to the Northern Cape, so part of that is still about the boundary issues and the way that's worked. But the encouraging thing, I think, is if you look at Eastern Cape, a substantial growth that they have, and that should certainly make a difference for them. And Limpopo, our other poor province, certainly a 19% growth in that area. KwaZulu, a little bit below that average, but they are also substantially funded. So that's the figures for the provinces. In terms of our particular boat 13, which is to come, the baseline, as I say, 18 billion, and you'll see how 16.3 billion rather. You'll see that it's broken down. In particular, about 80% of that budget is directly transferred to higher education institutions. as well as your National Student Financial Aid Scheme, that our baseline allocation is 1.1 billion, with teacher bursaries 120 million and FET college bursaries added to that. Sorry, that's NSFAS there. And the rest then broken down, another 2 billion in conditional grants to provinces, earmark funds, etc. And you will notice that right in the bottom line there, the departmental operations, the money I effectively have for running my department, is in the region of 500 million rand out of the total of the 16 billion that we have altogether. So it should be appreciated. Dramatically, in 2008-09, in fact, my operational budget goes down, and that's part of the efficiency savings that government has put in place. So we certainly are going to be under a lot of pressure in the coming year. There have been decreases in a number of areas, including our public exams system, but we will manage that, I hope. And then once again in 09-10 and 10-11, it does go up again, and we would be thankful for that. So that's just the broad sense of both 13, and if one looks at it in terms of programs, you will see that administration, there is a fairly substantial growth in the coming year, but I think as your researcher has picked up in this particular document, a lot of that is allocated to the new building which we are constructing. It is an investment, obviously. At the moment, we're in rented accommodation, and we pay a huge amount for that rent each year to some private company. We're saying let's rather do that ourselves. So some of that money is invested there. Planning and monitoring, fairly small growth, but they largely are policy units, so they don't get involved in program delivery. They will manage with that. General education, we have put a lot more money into that, and that's largely the Foundation for Learning program. Further education training looks like a drop, but part of that is the fact that the conditional grant, of course, now disappears in the coming year. So in terms of actual spending money, they would have at least as much as they had before. A huge increase in the social and school enrichment, but again, a large part of that is made up of the increase to the school nutrition program, which is diverted into provinces. So it's not more spending money as such, but more program money. Higher education is the allocations to institutions, and there's been an encouraging increase there that the subsidy levels to universities should increase, and we hope that with increased subsidy levels, universities would be able to limit the size of their fee increases. Their argument over the past few years has been that they've been forced to hike their fees above inflation because we've been dropping the subsidy level. We should be able to pick up on that. And then Program 7, Auxiliary and Associated Services, that's largely around support to provinces and various other bits. It's not a substantial amount. So that's how we spend, Chair, the 60 billion odd that we're allocated each year. And perhaps just further then in terms of the actual operational budget, how we make use of that. Apart of the baseline allocation, we've increased in the coming year our subsidization of public entities, that's SAQWA, Umalusi, and the Council on Higher Education. We've increased that by some 8 million. The expansion of Grade R and ECD, we've been given an additional 11 million there, Chair. The inclusive education, higher education, you see all the figures there, Chair, and that pushed our overall MTF allocation up to the 18.8 billion that you saw earlier. So those are the areas that we have been funded for, and that's certainly encouraging. You'll see the second to last line is the efficiency saving in brackets. That's the 9.2 million that we're bound in fact to save during the coming year on operational costs. It's not going to be easy, but we'll obviously have to do that. That's there. But I should, Chair, put that against the bid that we made. So, yes, we have received an additional 2 billion or so in funding, but the next slide indicates how much we, in fact, asked for as a sector priority bid. We asked for altogether some 17.8 billion additional, with another 2.7 billion for infrastructure. We asked for 1.7 billion additional for school nutrition. That was to try and extend it to secondary schooling. That was turned down, unfortunately. We asked for 1.5 billion for inclusive education. We only received some 4 million out of that. Grade R, we asked for 3.6 billion. You'll see we got 11 million out of that, together with ECD. Personnel, 7 billion. To a large extent, that has been provided for in the mandate and the provincial grants, so that would be flowing direct to provinces. And then I fear the most awkward one. We asked for $330 million to buy textbooks for grade 10, 11, 12 to ensure that every learner had the money available to them. Chair, we were very disappointed. The response of Treasury was to in fact say, no, 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 this is a provincial function. Now, we really have to challenge that assertion. Our understanding is the Constitution talks about concurrent functions, which means that we have responsibilities and provinces have responsibilities. And we see no reason why, for example, on textbooks where you have enormous cost efficiencies by buying them nationally, buying huge numbers, and then getting them out to schools as quickly as possible, for us it seemed very disappointing that Treasury said, no, 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 you don't get involved in this. This is what provinces do. They have promised that they would add this $330 million onto provincial budgets, but our view is that they're already spending some $3 billion on textbooks a year, and somehow we still don't seem to get textbooks in every learner's hand. For us, it really is very unfortunate that we weren't given that money. So, Chair, over the MTF, out of that $17 billion that we requested, some $11 billion has been granted. Obviously, we do appreciate all that, but I think it's important for you to know that some of the reasons we can't expand some of these things in the way we'd like to is that our bids were not then totally supported by Treasury. So that would be ongoing political work we need to do. Chair, I'm sorry if I've been too long, but that's the story for this year. That's where we're planning to go. And as I say, we really would welcome the input and advice of this committee as to whether we are hitting the right spot. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, DJ. Good job. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sure you missed some more time. Unfortunately, there's nothing here.
We're living out. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. An elaborate explanation of how we will spend your money and your priorities and everything for the financial year. We appreciate it very much. While it is clear, but I do know that members of the committee want to interact.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Members want to give you the opportunity to interact. Not cheap. I don't know if it's cheap, it's the same kind of therapy.
Thank you, Chair, and let me thank the DG for the presentation. It's for me, but for a few questions that we started to ask. As I mentioned, of the Northeast School for 50% target, but it seems in most schools they are not applying that in terms of the exemption policy is not applicable. I don't know whether the department will also address the green child module because it's a cry when you do an oversight whether this school is supposed to be in green child 1 or green child 4. So I don't know whether it will be rejected by the department. Last week when we took Parliament to talk about the school, we visited one school in Pinel. That school is surrounded by informal settlements and are charging the rent at 240. And they also implemented this credit and then they're sending the lawyers to the parents to pay.
Mm.
And to ask when we see the school, it's supposed to be in the kind of a cooking center.
One.
By the building are good, by the surroundings of the community, all of them are formally settlement. So I don't know whether this quintal model will be set by this. And also to monitor this extension policy, because really if you send the parents the summons for the school fees, and the parents are not waiting, it was not capitalization of this FET. 3 years ago when we visited this FET, there were backlog. It maybe can be updated. Especially in St. Kate, where we visited in other areas. Building partnership, business and NGOs. I'm worried about inclusive schools or special schools. I think last month we said about 8 provinces I think the department is neglecting this sector of the special schools. Really, really, the educators there are frustrated. It was only, I think, in the Mpopo where in December the premier donated buggy and a venture to the, some of the schools. Even the directors from the province and district, they don't know what's happening in the schools. We do the monitoring. I'll talk for now for other members to question. I'll come.
Thanks, Chair. One is on the implementation of the Education Law Amendment, especially the portion of Section 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're familiar with all these many, many councils that teachers belong to. But I think once there's been consistent work, you know, generally usually
mm-hmm.
in the schools, so those certain the children are cut, those are hit and run. And you never come back to the school. The issue of the Section 2, I think it was raised in one school that I visited. They say, according to their, you know, it's like these hypocritical oaths that are taken by doctors. They are not supposed to set the nurse. So how is this actually going to be implemented? They contact one of these councils that they have, that policy in that council does not allow them to actually set. That's why I say I can't remember. It's just that I don't have my notes as I was doing the school dinner. But they mentioned one of those, that's why I call it the hypocritical oath, that says within those council guidelines or policies, they're not supposed to say, Lennart, it is not part of their job description. It is not part, I emphasize, it is not part of their job description to say, Lennart, because it violates human rights, it violates certain things. They mentioned quite a lot of long lists of citizens. I think also in one meeting I had, they also raised that thing to say, but now they cannot see themselves implementing that because it violates some of those principles of human rights and those principles of those councils that they activate. So the implementation part of it then is going to be very difficult.
Yeah.
Because they themselves are complaining that they are not protected when they are in the school yard. Because even the very same learners are carrying dangerous weapons. Or some people actually bring in drugs and whatever, and these learners. So, meaning, wow, they cannot implement that. And yet, so meaning it is a long and perpetual story,
yeah.
A never ending story. So, how is the department going to assist in ensuring that, you know, that legislation gets implemented, especially that portion that is meant to. And then on conditional grants, I don't know to what extent is the department actually monitoring. I'll want also to put an example of some of the schools that is in the setting for this point, where the school feeding team has been two days. And they said even the district called them in and they were told on reducing it from 4 days to 3 days. They were called again, being reduced from 3 days to 2 days. And that comes back in one of the schools that I found in the therapeutic school. The principal is literally doing the cooking. He's cooking for the learners after hours, keep the food in the fridge in the morning, take the fridge food, put it in her car, and take it to school in order to ensure that the learners they actually see. I mean, out. No, within this money that is being allocated, but which is not actually enough.
Yeah.
And over and above, the volunteers, well, I'll say volunteers because sometimes it is volunteers. They're supposed to get a stipend.
Right.
Now, apparently, they're frustrated by the system somewhere. They don't get their stipends on time. In one school, they actually they went for about 6 months without even getting that stipend as part of assisting the school in doing so. To say, to what extent is the department actually monitoring to ensure that this money that is allocated to provinces are ready? So instead of having paper pushers there in the office, director, why don't you send people further down to actually see to it that this money that is ring-fenced specifically that children must eat? It's not actually diverted for other things. I'm told even the not as department, their salary bill exceeds billions, and yet there's a problem or shortage of teachers, I think, somewhere. So you wonder, what does this salary bill pay if there is such a problem? And you find it in certain environments or in certain townships or in certain households, especially where there are child-headed households. The primary child gets feeding at school, but the high school one is not fed. Now, I think, where are we actually going to find a balance at some stage? I know they say it is not feasible to feed high school. When in actual fact, in poor, very poor families, there is nothing that is to eat. It's only the young one who eat at primary, but the high school one, how do you check? I mean, as they are in primary, they get fed. Once they move over to high school, it means there's not enough food. To say, where is our consistency? In also meeting some of the NTT goals that we set ourselves. You know, by 2012 or 2014, we should have been feeding so many number of children and so on and so on. To say, we sign protocols, the director. But how do we go about making sure we stick to some of these protocols? I come to this issue of curry goals. I hear you saying you challenge us to actually identify 15 people that we can. I mean, I've got thousands of them. Now, I'm asking, am I not going to get frustrations when I say, here are people at a specific center we want to embark on that incident? What are we identifying? I'm sure I can go to my constituency even today and say, let's identify a center. Oh, we've got quite a lot of those white elephant schools that are now standing there. Nothing is happening. You say, we go all out and invite people. We need those who want to go on this literacy campaign, a program. Are we not going to get frustrations from the department when we say, here are people now? Instead, let's identify even a teacher prepared to pay the stipend, bring the learning kits, and so on and so on. And as I tell you, even now, something that can get going. If we can get that commitment and say, whom do we conduct from the department? Mm. If you want this learning kit, set up these things, and we get them rolling, and no stories, you know, and frustration of bureaucracy somewhere, and do that. And lastly, Chairperson, you know, I wonder if the department does have a report. I know you will say it is a concurrent function, but I'm worried about that example that you used of the state where they are actually closing some of these schools that have got less than 50 learners in the school and putting them in one school which has boarding facilities and everything. To say, what about the spending patterns in relation to that? Of course, it is a good idea, but what happens if, you know, if you compare rents and cents? To say, if we take learners from this area and put them in one boarding school, or if we leave these learners in that very same school where there are less than 50 of these learners or 100 of these learners, the teaching part of it, to say, do you have a comparison report of boarding school vis-a-vis still having those schools with actually and because now the problem is that as much as we say, we're trying to save costs here. I don't know whether we're saving costs or whatever. Mm. And yet we keep on saying, want to emphasize that the education of a black child should actually be a priority. But to find, we keep on having these multi-grades, where one teacher teaches three grades in one. And those are actually classified as farm schools or rural schools. And the issue of, I think there was one time that we actually proposed that the issue of non-standard, I think I'm using the right way, of saying this ratio of 40 learners to one teacher, when in actual fact the reality is that in your farm or rural school, you cannot be using the same measurement that you're actually using at an urban school. When an urban school is more accessible and a rural school, you find that you have to travel longer distances for them to actually go to school. At what stage is the department going to actually come out with that final statement, if not policy, to say, let's not use the same yardstick for your urban schools and your rural schools, because really, we need the rural education. You've got, I mean, even schools that were even built by churches a long time ago in 1945, and that the department is actually not even maintaining these schools. You expect good results and good education to take place when some of these
even a tiled floor. It is just a mud that was put together by current to make a floor, and nowadays it is actually well up and all those things. To say, to what extent are we really dedicated in making sure that useful actually gets whatever? And Chairperson, I think I will end there.
Thank you very much. I want to suggest that if you want to grab some courses on the things there, or give us some facilities, courses, can we maybe say for 2 minutes we grab, then we come back with you. Thank you.
There will be one coffee shop. So maybe members of the board, members are
the
coffee then we'll make another coffee. Yeah. For the
foundation
for the meeting.
Oh.
Then you will just make that coffee when they get.
There should be no teacher now who can say, I don't know what I should be doing. It's spelt out there in absolute detail.
Oh,
I'm going to go to the hospital.
are you observer? Oh, really? Oh, good luck. Is the Minister of Labour leading it again, or is it?
I'm not sure.
I wonder.
I don't know, government side yet.
Okay, it's Parliament side. Okay.
School
meeting seems to arrive late. Yeah. Thank you, Chang, and thanks to the two honourable members for those questions. Very pertinent, certainly. Let me deal with them in order. The no fee schools issue, I think firstly we must separate the exemption policy, and nothing has changed in regard to that exemption policy. The rules stand still in regard to those schools that are charging fees, and they must apply those exemptions. And I think all I can say on that, Chair, is if anyone is aware of an instance where the exemption policy has not been rightly applied, it's a very simple rule of thumb. It's if you earn less than 10 times the school fee you qualify for a full exemption. After that, it's partial, but that's the rule of thumb. And I can only say, Chair, perhaps, that if there's anyone not getting that exemption that they're entitled to, please let us know. Perhaps it's a good time, Chair, to mention, I hope we all know the call centre number of the Department of Education. We're really appealing to people to use it. It's well equipped now. We've got a few professional staff in there. They won't answer your question straight away. What they will do is take your question, they'll refer it to the section of the department, and they promise to call you back within 24 hours, 0800 20 29 33. Please encourage people to make use of that number. If they think they've been wrongly done, they didn't get exemption, they should, whatever it might be, please use that call centre number. It must be a mechanism we use. 0800 20 29 33. It might be a good thing every now and again just to call it, even if you haven't got a query, just to check if it's working. I think that's part of your oversight. Yeah, and let me know if it's not, and we will certainly pick up on that. In regard to the question of the quintiles, which is probably more substantial, I don't think we can do away with the quintile system, because all the quintile system is a ranking of schools from richest to poorest. So that has to be there. But I do agree with you that the issue of schools being placed in particular quintiles is obviously a recurring problem. And what we've tried to stress there, Chair, is that although we do use SASSA data, census data around the poverty of the area, and in the end the school is ranked according to the poverty of the area, we have made it quite clear that there is discretion for provinces to adjust those quintile rankings. So, you know, we do get now schools in relatively rich areas in which many learners come from elsewhere into those areas, into those schools. Now, clearly that's a mismatch, and you have to adjust then that school and move it down a quintile or two if it is indeed attracting poor learners into it. But, of course, we need to remember that if any school moves down in the ranking, then another school has to move up instead. That's how we have to maintain the 2020-20 quintiles. But certainly there is discretion. So once again, Chair, I think if you are aware of a school that is wrongly placed, clearly doesn't fit the quintile 4 ranking in this case that has been allocated, please make sure that that school is approaching the provincial department who's responsible for allocating the quintiles and make sure that it is indeed placed in the right quintile. That's absolutely clear. Chair, the other thing, though, I think around no-fee schools, and I think why people have expressed some concern about it, we do need to recognize that 2007 was the first year we implemented this no-fee school policy. The difficulty seems to have arisen in that the allocations paid by the province to the school, the money that they should now be getting instead of the school fees, in too many cases that was paid late to the school. They only paid it even in March maybe sometime. And the truth is, of course, that a school needs money to start the school year. They have to buy chalk, they have to buy some paper, they have to get stuff going. And normally school fees kept them going until they received the school allocation. Now suddenly they're not getting school fees. It is a problem. Chair, we just discussed yesterday with all the provincial heads that from this year, the first allocation for a no-fee school would have to be made in November this year for January next year, so that school was able to buy the chalk, get the things, the basic textbooks, whatever. So day one, when they started the school year, there should be no problem about them now trying to find and scratch around with school fees, etc. So in a way, it's about the administration. As I say, it's an early start last year. We've got a bit better this year, I think, and certainly we'd want to make sure that next year no school felt in any way disadvantaged by being declared a no-fee school. That's what's happening at the moment. Some schools are saying, oh, no, it was better when we're actually a fee-collecting school. We want to take that away and make sure that that disappears altogether, that schools want to become no-fee schools and generally get the benefit of that that they'd be doing. And I'm very pleased to say, Chair, that in most of the provinces, they are increasing the allocations to our no-fee schools. They're getting bigger and bigger. They should be able to give them the kind of funding that will enable them to deliver a quality education. So it's something we just have to watch, but please do work with us on that one if we find that schools or provinces are not doing what they should be doing. In terms of an update on the FET recap, I think we'd certainly be willing to provide that. As I say, we're into the last year now of that money. that conditional grant. I have, in the last couple of weeks, had to reallocate some of that money. We are allowed within the province to reallocate it. So from one college where it might have been allocated, if they couldn't spend it or weren't spending it, then we have actually moved money to other colleges within the same province to try and make sure that certainly the money is used and well used. But I think, Chair, what we'd want to come to you with is a presentation, perhaps, of each of our 50 colleges, where they've used that money, what they've done with it, and then I would hope at some stage you would want to be able to visit those colleges also and just check that what has been done is appropriate. The issue of the special schools, Chair, I did acknowledge, I think, that there was a concern about this. I think what happened is that when we published the white paper on inclusive education, we almost had a swing of the pendulum. So instead of now special schools, now we were going to have inclusive education where all our children with special needs are going to go into mainstream schools. They're going to be accommodated there with the facilities and teachers are going to be trained, etc. And I suppose it was a nice but a rather ideologically driven belief. And I think this is the kind of instance where the minister is saying, but what is the evidence for this policy? And the evidence, in all honesty, Chair, is that there are many, many children who need a special school. Finishing class, they are not in a position. They are seriously disabled, they have serious learning problems, whatever they might be, that clearly need special education. So we've now started to shift the pendulum back a little bit. We're not saying inclusive education is wrong for children who can be accommodated in mainstream schools. Absolutely, they should be. But we recognize that we do and will always need special schools, and therefore we have started to look at greater investments in them. I'm happy to say that besides the money the Premier has put into those Limpopo schools, we ourselves have taken some of our little discretionary money that we've got, and we've also assisted with some devices and toilets we've built in some schools, which were clearly unacceptable in any school, let alone a child with special needs. So I think, Chair, that's just an emphasis that we need to continually put on, and as I say, make sure that we don't just put all our effort into the inclusion side, but make sure that there's also that part that is given attention, and we will certainly be doing so. Chair, on the, I think that was the first set of questions. On the second set, Chair, from the Honourable Member, the Laws Amendment Act, of course, it is now no longer a bill. It's been signed, look, if you recall it, in the legislation, although we gave legislative basis for search and seizure, we also promised in that legislation to develop both procedures and to identify the devices that should be used. Now, in fact, we haven't even promulgated those yet. So it's probably early days to even be saying to teachers that they should be doing this thing, although clearly those schools that are doing it, we're certainly not going to say stop it there. I'm not aware of anything in the SACE Code of Ethics that would prevent this thing, but I'm glad you've alerted us to it. I'm certainly going to go and look at that code of ethics and see if there is anything there. I think the code of ethics certainly does talk about, you know, we shouldn't be molesting learners or anything like that. But I would want to say again that I think it's perhaps our emphasis on rights rather than responsibilities. I don't think anyone has the right to carry a dangerous weapon, and if anyone says that you're now infringing my rights if I'm going to search you for that dangerous weapon, then we've got to say that, hold on, what about the rights of the other 1,000 learners that are here in the school, etc. So I'm sure we can argue that case and explain it in that way. Of course, we have stressed it's not only teachers that we're expecting to play a role here. We are looking to community members as well to possibly play a role. You know, we don't want to turn teachers into policemen, and that's what the teachers have rightly said. But let's also be honest. There are many schools which are doing this kind of thing, and those schools have had remarkable success, and the key, they always say, is get the parents behind you. If the parents are with you on these things, then there's no child who's going to be able to say, no, it's my right this, it's my right that. The parent body is behind. These things happen, and there are, I think, in fact, some sterling examples in this part of the country of schools that are doing this thing and have said there is no question they deal with, and you know, very often the drugs and the violence are related. Many, many times these things go together. They have said quite clearly that this kind of approach, search, seizure, and make it known, make it public, etc., is certainly of benefit to the school. So we certainly want to continue with it. I think what will be important is we would want to share with you those draft procedures and devices as to how this thing is done. So as you said, to make sure that no learner is harassed, no learner is suffering any sort of indignities as being part of the search procedure, but I think you would have sensed the enormous public support we got for that legislation. Everyone saying do it carefully, do it correctly, and all of that, but no one was saying that we shouldn't be doing this thing. So let's try and make it happen. We will go and talk to SAFE as necessary if there is any contradiction of the Code of Ethics, but I'd be very surprised. I think that might be a particular interpretation that someone's giving to it rather than what it actually is saying. Chair, on the conditional grants, certainly we do monitor, and particularly in the school nutrition program, we've got a team of monitors permanently going down, right down to the ground level to check what's happening and what's not happening. So we do get, I think, a very good picture of what's working and what's not working. And as I say, we just had this independent study by KPMG, which involved a doctor, a nutritionist, and various others who were looking at every detail of the program. And as I say, overall, did indicate that it was a successful program, but identifying some of the issues. One of the things we need to recognize, Chair, is that while they are conditional grants, and therefore we do have some powers in this regard to manage and ensure they're happening, the only sanction that I have as an accounting officer is to withhold a next tranche of that conditional grant. So if the Eastern Cape is not spending their money, or if my monitors tell me, no, it's not getting to schools, it's not doing this, it's not doing that, the only leverage I have over the province is to say, well, then I'm not going to give you your next lot of money until you sort these things out. Now, the effect of that is that you're going to get even less feeding taste and taste. It really is not an option that I in any way would be keen to exercise. Now, clearly, if money's been wasted, then I will. But if it's an administrative or logistical problem, it doesn't really help for me just to say, well, now I'm going to withhold your money and go and sort out your problem and make sure children are getting fed, and then I'm going to give you your money again. You know, it really is not the kind of sanction we'd want. We appealed in the Minister of Finance presenting his Division of Revenue Act in Parliament this year. One of the provisions of conditional grant money is that if one province is not spending that money properly, I can pull some of that money back and give it to another province. Now, that's fine, and, you know, in the colleges, for example, we've done some of that shifting. But if the Eastern Cape is not feeding their children, I can't take that money and now give it to the Northern Cape and say, oh, well, you're going to feed your kids instead. No, that's not helping the situation. We appealed to the Minister of Finance, the department from my side, to say, why don't you also allow, if they're not spending the money, instead of me just taking it and giving it to another province, why can't I take that money back to my department and then I'll just appoint the service provider and say, go and feed children in Eastern Cape?
Yeah.
No. Division of Revenue, national, provincial, concurrent, separate function. They said, no, 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 this is provincial money. It can go to another province, but it cannot come back to the national government. And therefore, our hands are tied in that regard. So, Chair, I have to say, I'm very limited in many respects in how we... Yeah, the conditionalities are fine. I can say you only spend it on ABC. But the truth is, if they don't spend it, I have very limited powers to actually intervene and do something different in a particular thing. And I really would appeal, I think, to yourself as lawmakers to see whether there's anything that could be different there. The issue of Northwest is a particular problem. They completely overspent their budget altogether in education. They're about $800 million, I think, overspent this year. It's a huge financial crisis. There's no additional bailout from the province, they've said. It's really a problem. And, of course, that's found its way through to many programs, including the school nutrition program. Now, with respect, some of that has been of their own making. They do feed a large number of quintile 4 and 5 schools in the Northwest. Now, maybe, again, it's the definition of which quintiles, et cetera, but our conditionality says you should feed quintiles 1, 2, and 3. You've got enough money to feed for all school days, quintiles 1, 2, and 3. That's the basis on which we allocate the money. In a sense, they've made these choices. It's very difficult now to stop feeding, and we'd all understand that, to suddenly tell a school, no, actually, you quintile 4 you don't need, and we're stopping your feeding. Clearly, they haven't had the political will to do that. But that ultimately has been what's put pressure on them in regard to their budgets, and that's why they've had to cut back for the remainder of this financial year. I can only hope that from 1 April, when they get the new allocation for the new financial year, they will then fall in line with the national norms, which say quintile 1, 2, 3, primary schools, all schools. school days, 198 school days a year should be feeding. You raise the issue, I think, again, of the secondary schools. As I say, Chair, we put in the bid to get funding, and we would certainly have liked to have extended the program to secondary schools, but I would hope you agree that when you've only got a certain amount of money, either you can concentrate it and do it well for a certain section of our school learners, or we could spread it more thinly and we could do primary and secondary, but to be honest then, Chair, we're going to drop down to about 70 cents a day. You're not even going to give them a slice of bread for that. Yeah. So in the end, I think that's a budget issue that we have no control over. The stipends, I will look into and find out why that is not being paid. If they are commitments that are being made, and we have agreed that volunteers, particularly around the food gardens and food preparation side, should be receiving stipends, I will check with the province and see what's happening there. In the end, that is a very important part of both the employment creation element, but in fact a very good community mobilization issue as well. So we've encouraged that we do bring in volunteers for those, and that they should indeed be paid the stipends. Chair, on Karagule, I sense your concern, and of course that's why we have established this unit at what's described as an arm's length from the department. We have put Karagule in a position where in fact it is not tied up with government bureaucracy. We have, in fact, established a separate office for this unit. They're outside of the department. They have a separate CEO. We call it a CEO because we want them to be fully responsible. They've got their budget. Clearly, they will account through us as a department, but they certainly have the freedom, the autonomy to respond as they need to particular issues. So, Chair, I would want to give you the number of the CEO, but I'm not going to do that, but I will convey to you that they also will have now a call centre number. Karagule will have its own call centre number. I've just requested the information on that. I don't know if it's come through yet, but we will give you that certainly, and that should cut out any of that bureaucratic nonsense, all right? When Karagule gets approached, we want them to be a responsive unit. That was the mandate of Cabinet, to say we want this thing to run. It must be under government leadership, but it's not an ordinary function of government that flows through the normal kind of processes. This has to be a responsive outfit, and I would hope, Chair, that you won't get any stories, any bureaucracy from them. Again, let me say, if you do, give me a call directly, and I will respond to that. But they are committed and able to. I've just been alerted that over the past while there's been a fair amount of media coverage, also calling for the identification, in this case, of volunteers to do the tutoring. They'll be followed by a call for people to register as well. In those adverts, you will see the numbers, the contact details, etc. We have a provincial coordinator in every province, and they would obviously take responsibility for that. So, Chair, I think this is a mass mobilization campaign. And we want to make sure that no one is kept out of this program because of either where they are, who they are, what they are, or anything like that. So let's make it work. And as I say, I think we've set it up in a particular way. You might have seen that what we've done to support this unit is, in fact, contracted a big accounting firm. It's SAB&T, and I'm not sure who they are. It's not SA Breweries, I know that, but who they are, I don't know. But they, in fact, are providing the administrative support to Karagule. So again, for example, Karagule needed computers. They didn't have to come through the department, through the CETA, through tender, or anything like that. They went to this company and they said, we need 30 computers. The next day, 30 computers were there, they in the office. They needed office accommodation, SAB&T, found them offices, full stop. They don't have to go through public works, nothing like that. They got the offices, they equipped, they're ready to run. So that's the understanding. The 80,000 or so volunteers that we're aiming to recruit into this program to do the teaching, they will in fact be recruited and paid for by this agency. So again, they're not on first cell, they're not part of department appointment procedures, anything. We get them, they do the work, they get paid, finish, and move on that one. So really, I think there's a different logic that is driving Karagule. So as I say, I hope that you will see it in that way, and the response you'll get will be of that nature. Yeah, I think the question about the schools is an important one, and the possibility, the issue of school closures, etc. And let me stress that while obviously from our side, the issue of cost efficiency is a factor, we need to take that into account. As I say, very often you'll have a small school with 40, 50 learners, but you still can't have less than two or three teachers there. So, you know, normally three teachers would be probably equivalent of 100 or so learners. Now you've got three teachers, well, maybe 40, 50. So there is an expense involved that is of concern to us. But I will still say, more importantly, is they are educationally inefficient. As you say, the multi-grade type class is not ideal. We often find that, you know, then the one teacher's taken away in a course, you're only left with two teachers, classes without, whereas in a big school with 30 teachers, you can mix and match and you let one teacher go and the other fills in and you've got all those sort of management possibilities. You don't have that around a small school, and that's, as I say, where educationally, I don't think they're effective, and that's what we're doing. We had a meeting last week, it was a joint MinMec with the Public Works Minister and MECs, and our Minister and MECs, and it was focused on this eradication of mud schools, but we are understanding mud schools isn't only mud schools, it's any unacceptable structure, and we're talking about how to deal with that. And all of the provincial heads were very clear of education, were very clear, they said, let us not assume that wherever there is a school, that ought, and it's dilapidated, that automatically we should be replacing that school. For example, the head of Limpopo is quite adamant. He's got schools, and the MEC was telling the story, that in the end, they set up there because a particular chief wanted a school on his or her territory. The chief next door also wanted a school, so there's a school there, and there's another one, and there's another one. And they really said that they need to guide as to whether all of those schools were viable going into the future, whether we should indeed be investing money in rebuilding those schools, or whether you couldn't say, look at these four schools now, all around within a kilometre or two of each other, surely we just put up one decent school and those four schools then get amalgamated into that one. So there's a very real sense that our schools, as they're located at the moment, were not driven by a real planning process. They were driven by a whole lot of other interests, and people who wanted a school here, wanted a school there, this one didn't like that one, so they put up a school here. And many of our mud schools, you know, even heads of departments saying, are not even registered schools. So, you know, people tell us about a mud school, they say, but then we look in our books, there's no such school, and they go there, and yes, there is a school, community's paying a teacher something, and the censors now, they're saying to the department, you must replace the school and you must pay for a teacher, and the department's saying, no, there's no reason for a school here, there's one around the corner, much better, well-equipped, etc., go there. So it's that planning function that I think we first got to do, and of course the NEEMS data is very useful there, but it does mean, as I say, that it can't be an automatic assumption that wherever there is a school, that there automatically should be a school and that we should invest a lot of money into refurbishing that school. We do need to think it through. But it will be part of the norms and standards, the understanding what a school is, what it should look like, etc. And there would clearly be particular norms around rural schools. We've got a unit now that is starting to do a lot more work around those rural schools and trying to deal with many of the complex problems. One of them is governance. Most of these rural schools do not have an SGB. They can't have a, you know, again, when you've only got 30 learners, it's probably only 10 parents maybe around that. You can't have an SGB from 10 parents. You know, it's just not, it's not a viable structure. So many different issues that we need to deal with in rural schooling. But one of them, as I say, is at least the organization of those schools and how they work. You know, I think we all have our concerns, rightly, about boarding schools. But when you see those kids in the Free State who have been brought through to the boarding, and Free State have done very sensitively, they brought the parents first into that boarding hostel. They said, now this is the bed, this is where your child is going to stay, this is what they'll have. And, you know, these children are now getting three good meals a day. They're getting supervised homework in the afternoon with teachers, hopefully a safe, secure place to sleep for the night, that sort of thing. I have to say that educationally they are going to benefit from it. And the nice thing is, it's a Monday to Friday, so Friday evening they're transported back to their home, they do spend, the socialization is still there, but in terms of educational benefits, I have to say, I think these children are going to benefit. So maybe if you want your visit to the Free State might be appropriate. Let's go and talk to them and see what they're doing and how they're doing it. They're doing it, Northwest is doing it, and Mpumalanga is faced a little bit with it as well. So all provinces are grappling with this issue of our schools and where they're located and trying to understand that. Okay, I hope I've responded to your questions.
Thank you, DG. Before I ask other members, just one small follow-up on this whole question of school nutrition. I understand the frustration that you seem to be in also in terms of stepping, I think, on the ground. The condition for this is the condition only that, the only one condition to say, this money is meant for feeding children.
No,
or are there other conditions?
No, we go beyond that. From 1 April, it will be that you will feed children for 198 days a year with meal costing R1.50 per learner per day. The norm also specifies before 10 in the morning. It's not going to be here. The sun arrived late. It's no good feeding children at lunch after school. I mean, sure, it's good. They get fed. But if you want the difference in learning, you must feed them early. We're actually looking even now at a second program that will actually be a breakfast program. So we're saying before school, a bowl of porridge something, and then maybe later in the day, 11 o'clock something, a sandwich like that. So, no, the conditions go beyond just that you must feed school. We specify how you must feed them.
But is it not possible that to, as one of the conditions, to see to it that they follow the Northern Cape model, all of them? We're going to say in the Northern Cape, the money is actually given to the schools.
Oh.
And the schools are able to do it. They get local women there, provide food and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to work very well in the Northern Cape so far.
Mm-hmm.
Can we make that as one of the conditions to say, this money, okay, goes to the province.
Mm-hmm.
The province must say that it goes to the schools, but the schools then must be able to report.
To report
to say how we were actually done. Because otherwise,
let us give you this KPMG review report, because that did pick up on that particular issue. I mean, their view was that it can't be a one-size-fits-all, you know, that what works in the Western Cape is not necessarily going to work in Limpopo, yeah? And you see, Limpopo and Eastern Cape will tell you, if I send this money to the school, where's the school going to buy the food from? There's not a shop in the area, there's not a supplier. So their argument is they do need to centralize it somewhat, and maybe not, you know, right at the head office level. Well, at least the district level, that's right, and they contract a supplier, etc. So, you know, their view was that it is appropriate to possibly have different models. And I'm not sure, to be honest, that in the Eastern Cape it's the model that is at fault. I think it's the management of the model. It's, one, the management of the suppliers. I think there's some very crooked suppliers, sadly, and, you know, that's the problem. It's also related, many suppliers are saying a school less than 50 learners. You know, that school is 20 kilometers on a dirt road, and they're dropping off 2 loaves of bread. Ah, forget it. I'd rather go to the beach. Yeah, so it's that sort of complexity as well. So, yeah, I wouldn't like to say that, yes, we will all follow that Northern Cape model. It works in the Northern Cape, partly because it's a
rural province.
It is rural, certainly, but the schools tend to be centered around at least villages, small towns, so there's a supply there. Limpopo, Eastern Cape, there's schools that haven't got a shop within 20, 30 miles, so it makes it a problem if you just say, here's the money, you now find the food somewhere. It's not going to work. So we'd have to look at that and say, let's share with you that report, and perhaps on the basis of that we engage further.
No, that's fine.
But let me just say, overall, the minister has expressed the view, and we're pushing it now, that more and more money generally, not just school nutrition money, should flow to the school level. This business of Section 20, Section 21 schools, the minister's view is that, in fact, all schools should be Section 21 by default, and only if there's evidence that they're not managing it, then you pull back the function to the district. At the moment, the truth is, many schools are Section 20, the district holds the money, the district makes it very difficult for the school to spend that money. And actually, is what is happening is that some of the Section 20 money, the schools that need it most of all, is in fact not getting to them, and at the end of the year it gets returned to the province. Section 21 gets it, it's in their account. If they don't spend it, no one even knows. Although that might change. They're looking at bringing schools under the PFMA now as well. But ministers said, let's make all schools Section 21, give them all their money that they're due, and let them spend it. The evidence, and again, Northern Cape is one of them, and Free State, for school building. They don't hold the money even. They give it to the schools. And the schools are building those classrooms. They're building them cheaper, they're involving communities, and they're delivering more and more quickly than we can do it ourselves. So it's this assumption almost that schools can't do it, but we're good at this. And it's a flawed assumption. Okay? So we're encouraging more and more money to flow direct to the schools. We must watch it, because schools don't always have the capacity to manage that themselves properly, but with support we think they can do it. So I think the general gist is taken, but perhaps we'll talk more about that particular model.
Yeah, no, I think we need to talk more about it, because we have a lot of situation that we can't do that. Quite, for quite some time.
Yeah.
And our last follow-up is the last one is, the great schools or the rural schools that you are saying, you know, the problems that are there. I was saying, that it is not possible, and especially also the special schools, it is not possible to have different model of provision of, you know, long-term standards. Because obviously, I mean, they don't fit in the long-term standards of the ordinary school. If you take, for instance, a special school and you want to provide teachers the same way in which you want to provide for an ordinary school, they need other kids, they need so many other people. But if you want to do the same long-term standards that you do in a school next door there, which is for normal children.
On the post-provision of teachers, there are separate norms. If a school has got any disabled learner, you know, the way that teacher provisioning works, that you count the number of learners and it divides by number of teachers. But any learner with a special need is counted as either four, five, or more learners, equivalent. So a special school would, in fact, have a much more generous provision of teachers. That's why, as I say, the cost per learner in a special school is so much higher, that staffing cost is increased. I'll have to check whether the non-personnel, non-capital allocation is higher. I'm not sure if that's the case, and maybe there. But certainly on the staffing side, they are hopefully given what they need, although they'll probably say it's certainly not sufficient. Yeah. Not that I'm aware of, no, and then maybe that is an issue, although by default it tends to be, as I say, very often you'll have 50 learners, and they will in fact have three teachers perhaps, whereas the norm would probably say they should only have two, yeah? So it's a deviation from the norm rather than a different norm.
Yes?
Oh.
Before you step out of that issue, what
Director
Mohene says is not the reality that is happening in
the
To say that the issue of more staffing based on the count one child and five kids is not happening. It's not like that. That's why I'm saying maybe it's about time to push some of these officials out of the offices to go down to school. Because I think you'll be getting the report on special schools that they've combined. It is a sad state of affairs out there, where even teachers have to pay from their own pocket to get an assistant to come and help them in a class. So, meaning, some of these things, Director, they may sound easier when they are said. But if you go to the real, real situation, they are not like that exactly. I want to go on what you are saying pertaining the issue of taking money to school. That they also they need to put in caution, so that then when they give that money to a school, it must be ring-fenced for a specific purpose. Like you are giving an example of me, in some schools they are even able to build classes and etc. and all that. Other schools, Member Grace tells me that the principal is saving the money, say, I want to build a hall.
Yeah.
When that money is not meant for a hall, it's meant for something else.
And
there's
no fence.
There is no fence around the school, but you're keeping 140 in the account just to build a hall.
No.
So meaning as you allocate that, when you come that time where you say you are giving that money to a school, you must specify for what purpose, so that they don't do any other thing that they are supposed to do.
Yes, now I hear you, although we've also got to put some confidence in our communities to be able to take those decisions. I would be curious to know, has that principal, for example, consulted the school governing body? What did they say is more important, a school hall or a school fence? If they're saying a school hall, I would be hesitant myself to come and say, no, it's more important you put up a school fence. So we've got to balance that perhaps also. We must be guided by local communities who presumably do understand their needs best of all. And school halls are very important because they're, of course, not just for schools, the community then uses them. They can be very important elements of building communities, etc. So as I say, I don't want to judge on it, but yes, you're right. We can't just give money and not know where it went. Yeah? School halls, school fence, I don't mind, but of course many of them go into drum majorette uniforms, go into end-of-year parties and that sort of thing, and that would worry us, certainly. Yeah? But yeah. The special schools, one chair, I'm absolutely not trying to say that just because we've got policy that these things now work in that way. And certainly if we can look at that report. And Chair, I would really want to urge you, and I think it's appropriate as an NTOP without dropping my colleagues in trouble, is you should be inviting some of the provincial HOD to come here as well and explain to you what they are doing about their special schools, and if you've got particular cases, they're going to be much better placed to be able to say, no, in this case, this is what we're doing, this is what we're not doing. Yeah? So I would certainly urge that you do consider that. Treasury does not provide explanations to that person. So, in all honesty, that question must be posed towards them. And I'm not, they've clearly got a huge number of priorities they're facing. They must deal with the fire train, the stadiums, and whatever. In the end, they decide on priorities, and all we get, Chair, is an allocation letter that says this is how much you've been given. There's nothing at the bottom there that says because of this, because of that, or anything like that.
About this section, my colleagues elaborated on that. There is a lot of corruption in schools. The money is used for individual I'm worried about the schools are because now, when you go around doing oversight, you find that now we short of teachers in the country, and no, kids are not expected to become educators. Now, how do you attract them? Because it seems now we are relying on teachers from outside Barbados. We recruit teachers from, for instance, Zimbabwe to come and teach our kids math and science, right? Because we let them. And my main worry, how far are we going to do this? Because now we are going to rely on other countries, not ourselves. And at the end, these countries will take over from us. Then, at Northwest last week, we were told that in one of the schools, there are computers, there's no teachers responsible for that. And that also gives me my main one, what's happening actually in our country. And the educators, that school was so overcrowded, in so much that one educator was teaching 700 learners in one classroom. 700, yes. Even
she was saying that it's out of her pocket, because the department, the provincial department, is just ignoring what they are complaining about, you know. So our township, there are so many retired educators.
Mm.
Is the department going to consider that educators who come there to the ministry, especially when coming to this curriculum thing? I think I'll pose that because some of my questions are answered. Then there was a question on, this advanced school principal has got, you said 400 already undergone the course.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have such a teacher in my position. But he's failing. In so much that the department has looked for a mentor for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know, what are they benefiting out of that? Because they come back from certain school and they do fail again, and the department is the responsibility of the department to look for a mentor. Thank you very much.
Thank
you.
Thank you, Chair. Let us come to the system of planning and monitoring. I don't know what the instrument that the Department of Education is using to measure the competency of an educator. Because in many instances, you see an educator who is meek and the educator who is making research, teaching them well, knowing the curriculum, knowing how to teach the learner, the individual learner. But then when coming to evaluation, then that teacher won't be regarded because he's not active as that one who is going around even showing the action that she's teaching while she's not doing anything. And then I want to come to this thing of monitoring by putting the system of post-school evaluation to come and try to get the information of the school from one educator. And then after that, the school is maybe regarded as not progressing well or is progressing. Maybe that teacher needs to be given more workshops to develop her, to be developed. But at times, the principal, I think, is the one who's supposed to do that, because he knows everything, or she knows everything concerning the school. Another thing, this one person, I've forgotten the name that is used for this. IQMS, yes. That IQMS, that is the most irritating system in the country. Because there are many people involved there. And some of the people there, like the peer or the what, they do not like you. They won't give you the relevant marks that you should get. So I don't know why the Department of Education is not using maybe the subject advisor to do that IQMS, because really it makes the educators to fight together, because they will just take small things and access to not in a proper way. So I don't like that one of the IQMS. That one only, and really it's making the educators to feel very much uncomfortable. I don't know why don't you get rid of that system? Because really it makes the educators to feel very, very, very small. Another thing that I wanted to talk about is, I don't know how to do this one. Because in the classroom you find learners and they differ in their behavior. But you'll find that those who are not coping well with the program, maybe it's just because because of the the gene disorder, then there's nobody there who can at least know that this is the gene disorder. Then the child maybe is mentally handicapped, but the signs and symptoms are concealed. You can't get them correct. So why don't we have this psychologist who can help, or maybe some teachers be trained in that field to assist the educators, because the educators are really getting problems. You'll find that this child is not quitting. The educators are worried about this child. And she's wasting, I'm sorry to say that, she's wasting her time to try to teach that child. Or maybe the child is wasting the time of the educator to take care of those who can cope with the program. That is the program that is common in the school. Coming to this one of the students, this one is really another one that one can't solve except the Department of Education. This business of depositing money in the bank of these women who are trying to help to feed the children, I think it's out of order. I'm sorry to say that, because they have to buy food from this money, they have to pay themselves from this money. Why the Department of Education does not come with the certain amount of money to pay this money, so that the money deposited in the bank is for the children to buy, is for them to buy food for the children, and then they know that their money will be given to them individually, not from this corpus of the school for and children to stay to.
Thank you very much. Let me also put some few questions to ask you in November. It is clear that this one of the members comes from the capital, you know, but it looks like. The unfortunate thing is that today in South Africa, 14 years after development, we still do not have a value for money in terms of education. It's a big problem. The money that you put into the system is far more than, you know, what you get out. And what is it? Where is the problem? What is the actual problem? Why is it that we're not getting value for money in our education? So that we are able to, in the sense, since the situation must correct something, we're able to correct that so that we're able to get money for value for money in education. That's one. The other thing that I want to ask you, what is your impression? Do you get the impression that, for instance, you are saying here that so much for the Eastern Cape, 14 billion goes to the Eastern Cape politics, or 17 billion is goes to the Eastern Cape in terms of education. But in the Department of, the treasury in the Eastern Cape, is it giving the education department in the Eastern Cape that 17 billion that is in the Cape? Is it getting that which is going for it? Or do they give some of the money to other, you know, and if you have a situation where the produce don't get that which is meant for them, what is it that you can do to correct the situation? You have indicated also, DG, about the training, I think, of district officials. I think this is long overdue. Our experience, when we go to different schools, we will find that even at the school level, they don't even have a copy of facts.
Yeah.
Now, imagine if a school does not have a copy of facts, how do they run the school if there's no copy of facts? And we expect the district officials to be the ones who provide the school with all those things. Now, let alone the amendments that will come up in a year. So many amendments. They don't have those things. And how then do you expect that these amendments are to be implemented as laws in the country when the basic thing is not even new? So the training of these people, that's the people that actually a very big backfire in our in our system. Once we get that right, I'm sure.
Yeah.
No, there's no proper monitoring of our system. Neither system is official. There are, there's this problem with DG that we have been talking a lot about this culture of teaching and learning in our schools for many years, year in and year out. But the merit of the situation is that in the township, especially in the township, in the rural area, that culture is available. It's not there. There's no teaching taking place. There's no learning taking place. You can go to Bukulethu now, I can assure you, you'll meet so many kids in the street, I mean, loitering there with uniform and the like. But you won't find that in town there. You'll never find that in town. And you go to Bukulethu to learn. So many kids are loitering the street in school uniform. They're not learning. There's no teaching. And that situation is seems to look like it is normal. You know? What is it? That the Department of Education wants to do to be able to address all this. I'm sure that some of these issues that you are raising are actually issues that were raised in the provinces. But you are frustrated because we are here most of the time. And we are working here. You are the people who are actually and unless we get that right also, we're not going anywhere. Now, the issue is IQMSS you spoke about. I think we're repeating this. This system does not work. It has actually failed. Now you're going to go out of the specific
I'll explain that.
But you are also saying here that a teacher must call the moderator to come in. Did you say that?
Effectively, perhaps I'll explain more about how that works.
Okay.
Yeah?
You know, but that's, I think, where the problem is.
Yeah.
In the IQ, you had a situation where the teacher would say, not today, I'm ready to call that one to come.
Absolutely.
And also choose the field or the way you want them to be evaluated. If you are teaching biology, for instance, you are too clear on the heredity, I'll teach heredity today.
Yeah.
But here's the accusation, actually. It's not given as a proper thing. By finding out that teacher only knows that part of the syllabus properly. The rest does not know, but you evaluate that teacher, you say, this is a good teacher, and that teacher gets all enough. So that's, I think, a very serious shortcoming of the system. The problem you showed us there, DJ, you're saying, what study means?
Yeah.
And you said that this will be probably in newspaper.
Newspaper supplements, yeah.
But the problem is correct, I mean, for instance, in the rural areas, newspapers are not, and people are not.
No, they go standalone as well. It's all the district offices.
Okay, fine.
So sorry.
One teacher asked me one day, you see, if in a village, there was one school identified as a village school, and the other one was also teaching medical science, what is the difference? How do you support this one and then give the other one? I mean, are you going to give them the same support? Are you going to discriminate against this? This one, which is not in Naledi school, what is the difference in terms of the support that they give to these two schools? One is in Naledi, the other one is not. And then, I think those are the issues that I wanted to. That's fine. Let's just leave it. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Chairperson, and other colleagues.
Can I add one?
Only add one.
The coordination of human resources, maybe DC can help us on that one, because really this vacancy rate in most departments are very high, and also strengthening the capacity of districts. Really, I don't know whether the district managers that got the role to stay to school. When we visit provinces, most of the district managers, they don't even know where the schools are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Really. Mm-hmm. And when we call, like last week we were in the Northwest of the schools, the manager of the district, because we said we must identify 7 schools, special schools to come into presentation. Now they did identify the schools, but after presentation from the school, for
principal for special schools. They were called to order those principals and teachers asked why do they prefer negatively about the school. And they were given a very harsh if I go down, I'll go down with you. But I think the third person taking it up is with the NEC of education. Because really those people are frustrated.
Yeah.
And one principal has been acting for 7 years. And with no, benefit as an educator. I mean, if you are acting, you are temporary. So there are so many problems. If maybe the department can focus on the special schools, the special the principals and the infrastructure, the support staff there.
I think on the ground problems are just too big. I really not think that our officials are not are fully some of them. Reports that you guys are getting and the like of the MECs are getting, maybe places report, but the reality on the ground is just different. You know? So the number thing. That was what I wanted to ask you. This 332 million.
Million for books.
For books.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you want to ask? It's not possible to, it's unfortunate. Right? It's unfortunate you must say that you could not get this money because we know, year in and year out, we're talking about textbooks in the provinces. Kids up to now, when they find out that I can't have textbooks,
they still don't have
them. They still don't have them this kind of thing. That was the right way to figure the end of our day. But they don't have them.
Yeah.
And that's just a very good idea that at the national level, you get these things being cheaper, buy and supply. But it's not possible to say that all of this money is actually taken from the province.
Chair, we can't deduct from the provinces, but let me just respond to that one directly. We have, in a sense, on an agency basis, agreed with at least two provinces so far, and I'm sure there are going to be more that are saying to us, no, we will give you the money, and you buy for us. It's the wrong way of working. It's silly you send the money to the province and they send it back to you, but so be it, it's working. But, Chair, I don't know if we mentioned last year, as part of the recovery plan when we bought textbooks for schools, the one book we bought, it was a very nice English workbook, it sells for 130 Rand in the shops. We went to the supplier and we said we want to buy 1 million copies. They said, yes, 30 Rand a copy. That's the difference. And they're still making money out of 30 Rand, I'm sure. So economies of scale kick in. Within 48 hours, we had that book flowing to our centres where those additional classes were being held. We proved, in a sense, we can do it. And that's why even Gauteng now is one of the... Eastern Cape is one, and we can understand the difficulties there. But even Gauteng, which is a well-oiled, good department, even they've said to us, that's fine, you buy for us, we'll give you the money. Yeah? So in a sense, we're working towards that, but that's the best, in a sense, we can do for it at this stage, Chair. But let me start at the beginning and just pick up on a couple. The comment about Section 21 allocation is absolutely right. As I indicated, Treasury is keen now to bring schools under the ambit of the PFMA. At the moment, in fact, they're not. So the school allocations, which total about 5 billion a year, are in some formal ways not accounted for. Now, it doesn't mean they're not accounted at all. Schools do have to submit an expenditure statement to the province, and that has to be audited in some way at the school level. But I would be, lying if I said that provinces closely interrogated those financial reports of the schools. So it's quite possible that, as you say, schools are spending this money on wrong things. Yeah, bringing it under PFMA will add huge administrative, burdens to the system. But in the end, it probably is a correct approach, and over time we'll deal with that. Chair, the Funzulu Sharkers, certainly the recruitment, as I said, has increased enormously. If you recall, that from about 1998 to 2004, when we had the whole rationalization and redeployment process, in that whole 6-7 year period, there was not one new teacher recruited. The whole thing was moving teachers from here to there. If the school was short, you took an excess teacher and you put them there, all of that. So the signal very quickly got sent down to the school system to say, there's no jobs in teaching. And there were many people qualified in that period who never got appointed, and there's probably still some who haven't yet been appointed. Of course, those circumstances have changed now, and there are clearly jobs in education, and the Fundulu Charter, I think, apart from actually giving the bursaries, has had an enormous role in sending that signal. What we found is that many children actually have applied for Fundulu Charter bursaries. They didn't get them, and they said, oh, well, never mind, I want to be a teacher anyway. They've been applied for another loan, and they've gone and studied as teachers anyway. So, in a sense, the signal, I think, is out there now that there are real jobs in teaching and more. And, Chair, we are quite clear. Our preferred route is, as the Minister puts it, to grow our own wood. The importation of foreign teachers, which we are doing now quite significantly, we've got about 1,500 in the system at the moment, foreign teachers, and we've just appointed now a recruitment agency who will go out into the world and get teachers on their books from India, from Africa, from anywhere else you might be interested, so that if a province says, look, I really can't find a math teacher here, they will contact this recruitment agency, they will give them a full list of people that say, these are the ones we've got on our books, you tell us who you want, they will do the initial vetting, checking qualifications, even the interviewing kind of thing, check on language competency, and if they are suitable, they will then bring them into the country. We've, of course, got the pre-approved work permit, so that can happen. But as I say, the appointment of foreigners, the use of foreigners, can only be a temporary thing while we once again build up our stock of local teachers, you know, so that's there. But let me also say, Jim, because the question was asked about retired teachers, we have a database of unemployed qualified teachers that we invite to put their names in the database, and whenever a province can't find a teacher, we ask them to contact us. We go through the database of people you hear, and in order to get on the database, one of the things you must commit is you'll teach anywhere in this country. And we've been able to help schools. We've got some 400 math teachers on that database. Math teachers in this country who are not teaching at the moment. So a school who needs a teacher should contact us. We will be able to provide them with the teacher. And that's a guarantee we've made. Unfortunately, because of our particular system of appointment, some schools, because the school governing bodies interview and recommend, they would rather have a local person who might not be qualified to come to the school than going to the national office and saying, can we have someone from your database? He might be from another part of the country, she might be, and therefore we don't want them here. We'd rather have our local person. So that's what we've got to break as well. And we've emphasized it's against the law to appoint an unqualified teacher. You must show that you have made every effort to appoint a qualified teacher first. And fortunately, where KwaZulu earlier this year had some 10,000 unqualified teachers, we're very happy that they've reduced that number dramatically. They've started appointing more and more of these teachers. So over time, I think we will ensure, as I say, the Stats SA Household Survey estimated that there are some 70,000 qualified teachers in this country. Not unemployed, they're often working in other areas, but they're not in teaching. So we do have the stock in this country. What we've got to do is make it attractive for them to come in and also make it easy for them to come in. One of the problems we discussed yesterday with the provincial head is that all our vacancies are published in Gazette, but the Western Cape, of course, just circulates this Gazette in the Western Cape. Eastern Cape circulates in Eastern Cape. Now, there might be a teacher in Limpopo who's not working and would love to come and teach here, but they don't get hold of this provincial Gazette. So we said, let's put all those Gazettes on a web. Based vacancies. So any teacher anywhere in the country can just look and see, vacancies at these schools, let me apply. We tend to work in our little provinces, as it were, and I think we've got to try and build this into an action. So over time, I think we are addressing it, but let me also say, Chair, if you're aware of any school that doesn't have a teacher for a subject, and obviously there should be a post for that teacher, contact us. I promise you within 48 hours, I will find a teacher who will go to that school and be appointed. So we should be able to do that. I must be honest, even with these 800 Fundulu Shaka teachers, not all of them have yet been placed in schools. Now, these were teachers who we've trained in scarce skill subjects. We've identified the scarce skills. We've trained them. They've qualified. They're ready. They have to work for government. And we find that half of them are not yet appointed. Now, the provinces have started putting them in sort of temporary posts, meantime, until they can place them. But it's a very complicated system that you shouldn't have any difficulty placing these teachers, and even those ones have not been rapidly placed into schools. So it's partly the system we have also of the SGBs recommending, etc. You know, it works the other way. I've got a school in Pretoria. It's got 8 math teachers. Only 4 of them are teaching math. The other 4 like being in that school. It's a nice school to be at. So they're doing a bit of English and some history and whatever. Yeah, it's fine. They're there. It's a school in Mama Lady without the math teacher. Mm-hmm. I have no ability to pick up that teacher, tell him there's a school there, and say, Becher's there. Go and teach. That's how I was appointed. I was told, there's a school. Go and teach. No one asked me if I wanted to go to that school. We built a system that provides so much choice. The school first has to agree that they want this teacher, so the SGB must recommend. I must negotiate with this teacher that it's all right for me to move you from here to there, even though it's half a mile across town sort of thing. We don't have that control. And that's an issue that perhaps not at the moment. It's time for massive legislative and policy changes, but I have no doubt in the first term of the next government we're going to have to. It was fine when we had a surplus of teachers. We're now dealing with a scarce resource. And with a scarce resource, you need to have control over that resource, and we don't have that. So,
isn't those
that go to Saudi Arabia?
Look, teachers will move. It's hard to stop that, but absolutely. There are so many countries that just laugh at us when they say to you, but why don't you just appoint a teacher there? And I say, no, I must first go negotiate with the school, then I must ask the teacher's permission, and if they don't, then the union will be on me. And of course, they just chuckle. I mean, Kenya is one country that has an absolute surplus of teachers. And the reason they do it is they have a teaching commission that does everything. It trains the teachers, it appoints them, it pays them, it's finished. There's no negotiation, there's no qualms. You get trained, you get appointed, you get paid, finishing class. And they work, you know. So, as I say, it's probably not time now for a change, but let's start thinking about that, because unless we get that right, we're going to be stuck with the current situation, and it's linked to many of your concerns. Again, with the computer science teacher, we recently agreed with all the Dinaledi schools that we had appointed an additional math teacher to all of them. Now, people said, you'll never find them. Within a week after advertising, we had 600 math teachers on our books. 300 of them were foreigners, mostly Zimbabweans. 300 of them were local teachers, and we picked them up, we put them into Dinaledi schools, we found them like that. So they are out there, Chair. We haven't got the systems right to, in fact, make that happen. This business of a teacher teaching 700 learners, that has to be a management problem within the school. There are, on average, one teacher for every 35 learners. The minute you find a teacher dealing with more than 40, more than 50, then you can promise that there's a teacher sitting somewhere who's not teaching. And if that one teacher is teaching 700, which should in fact qualify for 20 teachers, there must be 19 teachers somewhere who aren't doing their work. And that has to be a management issue in the school. So let's look at it. It might be management. It's also, of course, we need to recognize we have more teachers in this country than classrooms. So very often when you find a big class, it's got far more to do with the unavailability of the classroom than the teacher. So you'll have 2 classes bundled into one room, teacher teaching the 70 kids, but of course the truth is that other teacher who should have been teaching the other half is in fact sitting in the staff room somewhere. So please, you know, look at these problems, but really do interrogate the principal. How has this come about? How many learners are in the school altogether? How many teachers do you have altogether? And divide that, and that's what a class size should be, unless there's other reasons that can't be. The issue of the principal, as I say, this is the first batch we're putting through the ACE at the moment, the ACE and school leadership, and we will certainly be monitoring their impact, but this mentorship issue is one that a number of provinces have picked up. We all know the importance of a good leader in the school. A good leader, good school. There's an absolute correlation. We know that in many cases, either the province has moved the principal to another school, or a nicer option is bringing a mentor in to help that principal become a good principal. The truth is, many of our principals, particularly recently, have been appointed perhaps for the wrong reasons, not because they were good school leaders, but because they had other qualities that we might know about, and that has not helped us. So mentorship is an option, but it shouldn't be seen as instead of the ACE and school leadership. The ACE and school leadership is a training program. The mentorship one is more of a support kind of approach. Chair, I think the big question you asked about monitoring, et cetera, IQMS, is a very important one. So perhaps I'll come back to that. The issue of the IQMS, let's try and deal with that overall, Jeff. Let me say we're not going to ditch the system, in part because IQMS is an agreed system of performance evaluation in our schools. And if we scrapped it, then we'd have to go and start negotiating again with the unions, et cetera, and I'm certainly not keen to do that. We have a system. Our view is we need to improve it in order to make it work. And that's critical. And we have in this OSD agreement, and IQMS is just part of the OSD agreement, all right? IQMS will be the instrument by which we will measure the performance of teachers to decide whether they get the nice increases or not. But the two things we've improved on the IQMS, one is for the first time we will build into the IQMS, into the measure, the issue of learner performance. Now, unions, this has been, in a sense, the fundamental fight on OSD. They've accepted all the other parts. They didn't like performance evaluation overall, but they know they have to accept it. But most of all, they didn't like the fact that we would include learner performance as part of the measure of the teacher. Now, they didn't like this, and some have said to them, but how else do you measure a teacher? If your children aren't passing, you're not doing a good job. Now, they've raised the issue of context, and we do know that's important. There are rural kids who are never going to achieve what we know that a well-drilled, well-equipped urban school might produce. But we said we take that context into account. But for goodness sake, if all your class got 30% last year and this year they all got 40%, then you've done well. You're going to get a good mark out of that. It's not 40 is ideal, but it's relative to where you were and all of that. And we've said to them it has to be there. So that's the first part of IQMS we've improved, and it's going to be a critical one. And the second part, of course, is the moderation. So, when I say that they invite an inspector, it's not literally the invitation. But what it says is that the evaluation will first be done in the school as it is at the moment. And you're right, the flaw with that process we found last year is that, of course, everyone gave everyone 100%. You know, they looked after him and he looked after me, and we each gave each other 100% and it looked fine. And we went back to the unions and then said, oh, so there's no need for money for teacher development now because you're all 100%. And they said, no, that's not the case. Yeah? But essentially now what it will be is that you do your internal moderation, your internal assessment in the school. And as I say, if the school says you're satisfactory, then we'll say that's fine. You're satisfactory, we accept your judgment. But if the school submits a report that says these teachers are satisfactory, these ones are good, these ones are outstanding, then straight away that will kick in. We've just appointed now 100 at a national level moderators, IQMS moderators. And the minute, as I say, a school puts in a report that their teachers are good or outstanding, immediately a moderator will go to those schools. They will not give a choice of subject or anything like that. They will go, they will say, I'd like to see your lesson planning, I'd like to see your record, I'd like to see your learner reports, etc. And I want to see you teaching as well, and we've set a range of different classes and subjects, etc. So that will then say, yes, you are good, or no, you're no good, back down to satisfaction. So our view, Chair, is that yes, IQMS has been a flawed instrument, but it is the first instrument we've had since 1986 or so when the inspectors were chased out of class, and we're saying, let's keep it, let's make it work, let's make it more effective, and let's ensure that it's linked to whether learners are learning. That ultimately is the test of a good teacher, and if teachers are not willing to accept that as part of the judgment, then I don't think they belong in the classroom. So that is certainly there. Perhaps just also to comment on the whole school evaluation, the people who do WSE are trained supervisors. These people have been properly trained to do it. They're not ordinary classroom teachers. They're in many cases, former principals, etc. And, of course, they are asked to visit the school over an extended period. So it's not just a drop-in, drop-out. You said 2 or 3 days at least you spend at the school. But that is more of a development tool. We're not using that to judge a school in any way. That's one we're using to assess the need for development within a school. Does it need more resources? Is the infrastructure all right? Maybe the principal's a problem. Is it the teacher's parents? So it looks at 9 different areas of a school and asks about what's happening there. So it's a slightly different one. But as I say, I think the IQMS is going to now become the big instrument. And really, we need to make this work because this will be the system that will kick in the pay increases or otherwise. Chair, on the learner issues and disability, what we've developed now, and we can share with you, is what we call SIAS, the Screening, identification and assessment system for learners. So whether it's a learner who, as you say, is displaying one or other tendencies, learning difficulties, whatever they might be, we would then use the CIAS instrument, and again, we would expect trained people, not necessarily psychologists, but certainly teachers, officials who have been trained, who would administer the screening test, and they would then decide, does this child belong in an ordinary school, or does this child actually deserve to get into a special school, and if the latter, we would want to find the right place. So hopefully that will be there, and the CIAS is in fact an international instrument. Many countries use it, so we've simply adapted it for our purposes, and hopefully that will clear up the sort of problems you're talking about. The allocations on the school nutrition, look, we can tie it down and say this money is for food and this is for stipends, but in a way that also goes against, you know, we do know that schools make different arrangements with their volunteers. Some of them pay a stipend of this much, some pay that much, etc. Now, if we try to micromanage it, we might be killing some of the initiative that is there. So I think our view would be that we'd want to give schools a block allocation. What we might say is that no more than 10% or something should be spent on stipends and 90% should be on food. But I wouldn't want to tie the hands and say the stipends are so much and you can have so many people. Then it becomes really a management problem for us, and this is probably better dealt with at the school level. But we will take into account the need perhaps to ensure that not all the money goes into stipends and none for the food system. I'll come back to your big question of value for money, because that for me is crunch. But just quickly on the provincial budgets, the evidence has been certainly, Chair, that not all of the education money flows to education. It's definitely getting better, so I'm not going to say that it's an ongoing problem. One of the things we do now is what we call a budget standards exercise. We say that this is what we should be spending per item in the program, and we look at each province and we see what they're doing. Have they allocated for FET colleges or haven't they? All of those sort of issues. And then we've also now, for the last 2 years, sat in on their medium-term expenditure council meetings at a provincial level. So we help the provinces, in fact, to put in their bid to their provincial treasuries. We look very closely at their allocations letters. But what I'd like to offer, Chair, is that perhaps after the end of March, when provinces do have their final figures, that we come here and actually present to you what we've seen then in terms of spending trends and allocation trends in provinces to check that they are not getting it. The district officials, I think, Chair, we would deal with as part of the bigger picture. I think in part training is important, but it's not just training. If someone's attitude is wrong, you can train them till the end of the earth. They're not going to make good district managers. Yeah? And the truth is, once again, we've appointed many people either pre-94 who got appointed as district managers for the wrong reasons, and I'm glad to say that after 94, still people got appointed as district managers for the wrong reasons. Yeah? Sometimes they would need it to be out of schools. Yeah? The attitude of these district managers is critically important. One of the very worrying things is the terribly authoritarian approach they take towards schools. They almost act towards schools as though these are their juniors and they're, you know, we tell you what to do and we're district managers. You know? Now, we say to them, guys, you work for the schools. It's not the other way around. Schools are our business and you assist the schools. That's your job. But it's not an easy one to convey, and you're right, we've been in many cases, we've been to visit schools, and we pick up the district manager, and we say, can you just give us directions to the school? He's never been there! He's never been there! So we know this thing happened, and in the end, it's again, it's about accountability. Now, we are developing at the moment norms and standards for districts, which will define the functions of a district and spell out essentially how they should be working. But let's also be honest, I don't want to lay all the blame there. Many districts are completely under-equipped to do the jobs they're doing. In Limpopo, a district covers something like 1,500 schools. Now, a district manager can't see 1,500 schools, not in 10 years, not in a lifetime probably, yeah? So it's also about defining size and shape of a district, but also looking at the functions and most particularly the resources. Some district managers work out the back of their cars. They don't even have an office. So, you know, you're asking them to monitor something. How can they do it? And in all fairness, clearly, you know, district managers are rational people. There's a school around the corner from your district office. They're going to visit that school very often. That one in Gorbo, you know, 50 miles over bad dirt roads, he's got his smart car, yeah, he's not going to take his car on that dirt road. Yeah, well, I don't understand that, but yeah, we must accept that, and that's when the resources come in.
alignment. Not alignment is a reality. One principal of a school, I think it was in Kumala, of a special school, tells us that when the district manager comes, they say, how are you coping? You know, I'm not afraid of these children. You know, when the kids are, you know, not that type of level.
Yeah, attitude issue,
attitude is like.
No, it is a problem. But yeah, one of the things we must do is give every district the resources it needs. And if that means it's a 4x4 bucky so that he doesn't have to use it in CDs, give it to him. Yeah, absolutely. Make it happen. Yeah. Tata, well, I don't know. That's my favorite. So, in a way, we need a new cadre of district officials almost to actually understand the development task and role. And I think one of the things we're going to look to do is to establish a couple of model district offices. This is what a district office should look like. Build it properly, even put a computer center there so if schools in the area haven't got, they can come there and use, etc. Actually build it as a vibrant site of education delivery, and I think that would make a big difference. So it is a problem, and it's one we deal with there. Chair, finally, your question of value for money. Yes, there is a huge problem. International studies show us that compared even to some countries who spend a lot less than us, we just don't get the results we should be. It's easy, of course, to point to teachers, and teachers consume 80% of that money that we spend, and if teachers then don't deliver, clearly that money is not going to get the sort of results we want. And part of that, I hope, will deal with issues of IQMS, will be through IQMS now, where learner performance will be the issue that we'll look at. If learner performance isn't there, then we would assume that teachers aren't doing their jobs. But, you know, it's also a bigger thing around expectations, Chair. I was at a school the other day at 11 o'clock on a Friday, and all the teachers had gone and most of the kids. But there were some parents around, and I said to the parents, but aren't you upset and angry? And they said, what about? And I said, well, haven't you noticed your teachers have all pushed off? And they said, yes, but it's Friday. And I worked out that for them, this was normal. They had gone to schools where the teachers left early on a Friday, probably lived far away, and that still happens.
And
on the payday, you're lucky if you're 11 o'clock. You know, it's like it was earlier. The point was that their expectations were different. They had not realized that a good school operates from 8 to 3 every day, and very often much longer than that. Yeah. So it's also about building up those expectations of communities and ensuring that parents know what they should expect of a school. Now, in part, Chair, this is the broader community-based part of it, and particularly if one looks at the ANC's Making Education a Priority campaign, in part it's about that expectation issue. Now, you know, the commitment there has been made around the non-negotiables, making sure that teachers get to school on time, that they get there prepared, that they're in their classes when they're supposed to be there, that learners are there. When someone says, yeah, we go to an area and we find people, children, loitering around, what is the community doing about that? We have to ask. We can't afford to appoint truant officers. You know, maybe down the road we'll look at that. But meantime, is there someone in the community who's gone to that kid and said, why aren't you in school? What's happening? Is there someone who's gone to the district office and said, listen, I've seen a group of kids down the road here. So this is where I think, Chair, we really need the support of the community around what should be happening in our schools. Again, I'll say this, Foundation for Learning started to characterize that, but it's more than that. We all know that children should at least be in school between this time and that time. And it's, I think, an obligation on all of us to take that responsibility when we see a teacher in the bank on payday and it happens to be a school day, what's happening. Just last week, Chair, I'm sorry to say, I got a notice from Newcastle High School that they just received from the local branch of SADU. And Satu was calling a meeting on the 6th of March, happened to be a school day, 10 in the morning. Now, in an area like that, 10 in the morning doesn't mean you go to school first and then you leave. People are traveling at least an hour or two. The truth is, on that day, no Satu members were in school in that whole district. Now, we've written to the union, asked them to explain. But again, I would have to ask, where was the local community leader? Where were the politicians in that area? Where was the mayor of that town? Phoning up the Satu's leadership and saying, what on earth are you guys doing? You're supposed to be in school today. Your meetings happen on a Saturday, for goodness sake. We've got to drive that in a public way. We'll do what we can. But we've saw quite clearly, the community gets the teachers and learners to school on time, prepared, etc., sober, and whatever else we need. We will deal with what's in the classroom, and that's what the foundation campaign says. Once you enter that classroom, this is what you should be doing. But we need your assistance in getting people into that classroom and staying there, and at 11 o'clock on a Friday, the local politician should be at that school gate. And if anyone dares walk out of it, he should be saying something. So, in a way, Chair, that's what you've got to deal with. It's not just teachers, as I say. It's parents building up their expectations, for teachers to know that these things are not acceptable, for learners. And I'm very happy to say down the Eastern Cape the other day when Satu tried a similar thing down the Eastern Cape and called a meeting during the day, it was the learners who stood up and said, you're not leaving the school, it's your job to teach us. That's wonderful. We need to build more of that, but we need bigger community involvement funding. So, Chair, really, I think that's what I'd want to say about that thing. And I think more and more we are tightening up the system to the extent where hopefully we will see better and better value for money. It's the best promise I can make. Set up a storm of mine.
I will invite both of you. Talking about education,
yep.
There is this thing that there is no rapport between the Department of Education and budget policy. There are lots of talking tests. And how do we come up to, how do we really, you know, have a situation where teaching takes this propaganda like when there is no main stakeholder in education, not to the teacher? This is a problem for me. Nationally, what is it that we can do to sort out that question?
In Macau, I mean, Sokol used to be one of the Naledi schools, I'm not certain of that. Because when they start to meeting all together, there's no schooling for the day. I think there's something wrong with Satu, national and position. And as aligned to ANC, I think something must be done. My last point is the concern of the National Office of Teaching. I've been observing every time when there's a presentation, the gender balance is not there in the office. From 50%, they're not talking about 50. So there's any transformation in the teacher's office.
Not everybody, it's not a question, but also to, as a concern, because did you only speak about that calls VT.
Sorry.
Mm. When even the department calls training workshops during working hours. So meaning even the department must be the first people to teach by example. Don't call workshops during working hours. Don't call meetings of principals during working hours. Call everything after hours. Teacher training after hours. Even that weekend for that matter that you say. So meaning you must lead by example. That's all that I wanted to say.
No, thanks, Chair, and perhaps, sorry, I sort of understood the screening identification assessment tool as part of that, because part of that would say either you are recommended to go to a special school, or another conclusion of that instrument could be that, no, you stay in a public ordinary school, but you need additional assistance in that school. So that would be, I suppose, where the remediation would kick in. But let's also be honest, Chair, we have very few trained remedial teachers, certainly not enough in this country, and clearly it's going to be a while before we can guarantee that in every school we would have such a remedial teacher. So the likelihood is that a learner who's really suffering from those sort of issues would either have to be moved to another school where there is a remedial teacher, or, as I say, be taken into a special school in that way. So the point is taken, but I'm not sure whether we'll be able to get into that position easily. We are trying to assist in training teachers to deal with those sort of differential abilities within a class, but again, you would know in a class of 35, 40 learners, it is difficult in that way. Chair, let me just confirm that in my department I have 60 DGs and exactly 50% of them are women. So we are, I think, meeting the gender target there, but I apologize if the appearance has not confirmed that thing. Let me also accept the criticism. Absolutely, there are instances where departments, I would hope not ourselves, but certainly our provincial colleagues have called training sessions during school time. We've conveyed that to them as absolutely unacceptable. I would really want to suggest, Chair, that you might want to think about calling the SATU leadership to speak to your committee as well about their understanding of quality education for all, how they see themselves dealing with that. And I would hope, Chair, that in that you can deal with both this issue of time off, and you might want to raise also the question of the Eastern Cape political standoff. It is there. It is a problem. We have tried to intervene at a number of occasions and a number of different levels, setting up meetings between the administration and the SATU leadership there. It's part, I fear, of a bigger political context in the province, that there is a huge contestation there. And I fear, Chair, you're right, until there's some real sense of rapport there, that Eastern Cape is just not going to make the progress that it needs to. I've always said Eastern Cape and Limpopo in 1994 were in very similar positions. They inherited homelands, they were weak, they were poor, they were whatever. There's no doubt Limpopo, despite its obvious still problems, but it has made significantly greater advances than the Eastern Cape. And it's a bit of an irony, because the Eastern Cape certainly had a political unity that Limpopo couldn't claim, and yet they've managed to make that progress. So I think that might be more of a political issue that we'd have to pick up on. But I would hope, Chair, that you call all the teacher unions here and ask them also to talk to you about what their role is in these kind of things. Yeah?
Thank you very much. I suppose there's no more follow-up. I want to take this opportunity to thank the DG and the Kinahiparis for the engagement we had today. I think it was a very, very fruitful engagement. And we all appreciate people, all the programs that we are facing in education. And we are all together in this program, and we can only see the opportunity. But see if we work together. Very, very important. So, once again, thank you. Wish you safe change back to Victoria. Wish you well in your department. We hope one day you'll be able to overcome some of these problems that we have today. Thank you very much. Good meeting with us, yes.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much.
And besides that, they really need to look into the problems in
the North West.
Yeah. It's not that they really get the bulk of the budget, but they have the worst. He must not even phone and say, I'm coming. He must just do a surprise. He will show you the food. He can, he can give him a list of food. One moment.
The meeting is adjourned.
Chair, we did have someone at the MB, so certainly we will follow up on those. Yeah?
You did what at the MB, though?
No, I say we had people there at officials at the MB, though. So certainly we will be taking up all those issues. Yeah?
So hoping you also abandon the city.
I don't happen to drive one, but if I had one, I would abandon it.
You can't be driving.
VW.
VW. Yeah, it's a fastest car. My man.
I'm going to go back to
My man. Now, Ulta, Wednesday, Ulta. Let me tell you next week. Let me tell you where you're going from.
No,
Yeah.